Ja, wunderschönen guten Abend alle zusammen. Danke, dass Sie so zahlreich erschienen sind. Das ist um die Uhrzeit nicht immer so üblich bei uns im Haus. Und dann auch noch an einem Freitag. Aber ich glaube, wir haben alle ein spannendes Wochenende vor uns. Und deswegen freuen wir uns, Sie hier alle begrüßen zu dürfen. Wenn ich von wir spreche, dann haben Sie ja in den Flyern gesehen, die rumgegangen sind, dass es nicht nur eine KWI-Veranstaltung ist, sondern nur ganz im kleinen Teil eine KWI-Veranstaltung. Vielmehr eine Veranstaltung von vielen anderen, wie zum Beispiel Ernährungsrat, Valentin Thurn ist gerade noch hier. Vielleicht, um einmal aufzuklären, wir haben gerade noch ein paar technische Probleme, die gerade neben mir laufen, die versuchen wir gerade zu lösen. Aber wir haben ja noch ein bisschen Zeit, da ich noch begrüße. Also ich möchte Sie alle recht herzlich begrüßen. Wir freuen uns, dass Sie alle hier sind. Im Speziellen möchte ich auch alle Referenten des Abends begrüßen. Christine Pohl, Bruno Prado, Mark Winne, Leon Borlin und Wayne Roberts. Und zusätzlich auch ganz besonders den Staatssekretär Herr Bottermann, der Sie auch gleich auch noch begrüßen wird. Warum passt so eine Veranstaltung trotzdem ans KWI? Warum kann man das hier gut durchführen? Das KWI, das Kürzel steht für Kulturwissenschaftliches Institut Essen. Das heißt, solche Veranstaltungen in ähnlichen Rahmen und zu ähnlichen Themen finden hier sehr häufig statt und wir versuchen uns wissenschaftlich mit allem gesellschaftswissenschaftlich relevanten und allen politischen relevanten Themen zu befassen und ich glaube, da sind wir uns alle einig, dass Ernährung da ein sehr bedeutendes Thema ist. Das Thema der heutigen Veranstaltung ist Ernährungsdemokratie jetzt und auch das passt zu den Themen des Kulturwissenschaftlichen Instituts, denn wir haben unter anderem einen Forschungsbereich, der Partizipationskultur heißt, wo es gerade um neue Formen der Demokratie und der Beteiligung verschiedenster bürgerlicher Gruppen geht. Und wenn das nicht zu dem Thema Ernährungsdemokratie jetzt passt, dann weiß ich auch nicht. Im Hintergrund scheint es zumindest jetzt zu klappen. Das ist schon mal gut, das beruhigt mich. Ich brauche die Rede also nicht unnötig in die Länge zu strecken. Und da wir schon etwas später angefangen haben, will ich auch gar nicht mehr zu viel sagen, sondern gleich weiterleiten. Aber was wird Sie jetzt erwarten? Wir haben gleich nach mir folgt ein Grußwort von Herrn Bottermann. Darüber freuen wir uns sehr. Danach bekommen wir eine Filmvorführung zu sehen über den Film 10 Milliarden. Valentin Thurn sitzt selber hier vorne in der ersten Reihe. Dann machen wir eine kleine Pause und im Anschluss haben wir hoffentlich eine spannende Impulsreferate und eine Diskussion über selbige, bevor wir dann irgendwann spät am Abend enden werden und in die nächsten Tage übergehen. Viel mehr will ich jetzt auch nicht sagen und freue mich darauf, dass Staatssekretär Bottermann uns jetzt auch begrüßen wird. Danke vielmals.
Ja, guten Abend, meine sehr verehrten Damen und Herren. Eigentlich ist ja immer so, wenn dann so ein Staatssekretär ankommt, um die Uhrzeit eigentlich immer ein bisschen langweilig. Ja, das kann ich ja auch verstehen. Deswegen mache ich es auch kurz und werde Sie jetzt nicht mit langen Ausführungen langweilen, sondern will noch kurz reflektieren, wie ich das Thema des heutigen Abends betrachte. Erstmal Frau Pohl, Herr Thurn, Sie haben es ja hier alles maßgeblich mit auf den Weg gebracht. Und das Thema, was Sie jetzt in den nächsten Tagen diskutieren, ist ja in einer Zeit, in der wir ja in einem großen Wandel sind. Die große Transformation steht an, sicherlich ein ganz interessantes Thema ist oder ein spannendes Thema ist, wie es mit unserer Ernährungssituation weitergeht. Und in der Tat, die Menschen, die nicht mehr in der Landnähe sind, leben, die weiter weg sind, kriegen es ja kaum noch mit, wie Lebensmittel eigentlich produziert werden, wie Tiere gehalten werden. Und der gesellschaftliche Trend, der gesellschaftliche Meinungsbildung führt ja dazu, dass viele was ändern wollen. Und dass man was ändern muss in dieser Situation, ist völlig klar. Ich will Ihnen dazu eigentlich drei Anmerkungen noch machen. Erstens, wir haben das Pariser Klimaabkommen. Und wenn Sie die Nachrichten anmachen, hören Sie ja immer was aus Bonn. Und das Pariser Klimaabkommen ist für alle Vertragsstaaten, also Sie wissen, USA ist raus, aber ansonsten die anderen machen weitgehend noch mit, bindend, dass wir die Temperaturen bis 2050 auf rund 1,5 Grad halten, 2 Grad, möglichst 1,5 Grad. Und wir sind auch verantwortlich für die SDGs, die Sustainable Development Goals. UN völkerrechtlich vereinbart, die 2030 Agenda, und da steht eben auch als wesentliches Merkmal neben den bei den 17 Punkten, die kennen Sie sicherlich alle, so wie Sie sich mit diesen Themen da auch befassen, aber eigentlich die Menschheit zu ernähren, dass alle Menschen bis dahin auch gesättigt werden. Das ist ein ganz wichtiger Ansatz auch für Frieden und Weiterentwicklung in der Geschichte. Und wenn man dann sieht, dass ja das wissenschaftliche Konzept darauf, dass dahinter steht ja das Thema von Johan Rockström ist, die planetaren Grenzen, dass wir ja sozusagen unseren Planeten in vielen Bereichen ja doch sehr weit belastet haben und die Belastungen ja auch drohen, den Planeten zu zerstören, stark zu belasten. Und Johan Rockström hat gesagt, die wichtigen Punkte, um die es geht, das ist also einmal natürlich die Landdegradation, also sprich Flächenverlust, was ja täglich passiert, dann den Klimawandel, die fehlende Biodiversität und was ganz wichtig ist, den Stickstoff- und Phosphorhaushalt auf dieser Welt, der ja auch im Prinzip aus den Fugen geraten ist, aus verschiedensten Gründen. Und das ist nicht, wird jetzt nur, die meisten tippen sofort Stickstoff, Landwirtschaft. Nein, sind auch andere Einträge. Das Phosphorproblem, das über die Kläranlagen weltweit den Eintrag in die Meere verursacht, ist ja Grund letzten Endes für die Todeszonen, die wir in den Meeren haben. Ja, warum erzähle ich Ihnen das eigentlich alles? Ich bin ja nicht der gute Nachtgeschichtenerzähler, sondern wollte Ihnen dann eigentlich noch ein paar Inhalte bringen. Ich glaube, es dreht sich vieles um die Ernährung der Menschen zur Bewältigung auch dieser Probleme. Und das bezieht sich nicht nur auf uns hier in Deutschland, sondern das bezieht sich auf eine Veränderung der Haltung zu Lebensmitteln, zu Lebensmittelproduktion. Und auch ganz wichtig, unser Konsumverhalten ist an der Stelle eine ganz hohe Bedeutung. Und deswegen glaube ich, ist es wichtig, dass Sie sich damit auseinandersetzen und Ihre Ernährungsräte an der Stelle gegründet haben, auch die miteinander vernetzen, um dann an der Stelle auch neue Informationen zu bekommen und eine Art Vorbildfunktion zu haben und hoffentlich ohne andere zu belehren, weil das mag ich nicht, aber Vorbilder sind, glaube ich, an der Stelle etwas sehr Wichtiges. Und an dieser Stelle, glaube ich, haben Sie ein wichtiges Thema aufgegriffen, engagieren sich sehr stark darin, was ich sehr, ja, ganz toll finde, dass Sie dann auch den weiten Weg hier für einige von Ihnen nach Essen machen, um das jetzt in den nächsten 3 Tagen zu besprechen. Und deswegen, glaube ich, ist Ihre Aktion spannend, gut und wird die Gesellschaft weiterbringen. Und insoweit wünsche ich Ihnen in den nächsten Tagen hier einen guten Verlauf. Und nur die Anmerkung ist, irgendjemand muss das ja hier auch bezahlen. Und einmal die Stiftung Mercator, Entschuldigung, die Mercator-Stiftung. Die Mercator-Stiftung hat vieles hier getan. Und die landeseigene Stiftung Umwelt und Entwicklung hier hat auch ihren Beitrag geleistet. Also insoweit ist das Land auch mittelbar an dem Zustandekommen hier dieser Veranstaltung beteiligt. Und ich denke, die Förderungen sind hier gut angelegt. Und ich wünsche Ihnen viel Erfolg. Und Sie tun was für die Gesellschaft. Und ich denke, diese Kontexte sollte man sich immer bewusst machen, wenn man über diese einfachen Grundlagen, wie Nahrungsmittel produziert werden, verarbeitet werden und auch wie mit ihnen umgegangen wird. Und ich bin mir sicher, dass es hier bei Ihnen in den nächsten Tagen keine Lebensmittelreste geben wird. In diesem Sinne, viel Spaß, schöne Tage. So.
Ja, vielen Dank, Herr Bottermann, es geht natürlich jetzt dann bei dem Film tatsächlich auch um planetare Belastungsgrenzen. Und man hat es gehört, es ist jemand vom Fach. Also er war ja Generalsekretär der Deutschen Bundesstiftung Umwelt und vorher Direktor vom LANUF. Also es freut mich natürlich, dass jetzt in der neuen Landesregierung auch Sachverstand vorhanden ist. Bei den planetaren Belastungsgrenzen ist mir eines wichtig. Das sind ja von diesem Autorenteam, das waren ja mehrere, die das zusammengetragen haben. Die haben 10 Bereiche, Biodiversität, Ozon, was auch immer, zusammengetragen, wo es wirklich für die Erde eng wird. Und das Wichtige ist, und das ist das Thema des Films, 7 von den 10 werden von der Landwirtschaft verursacht. Landwirtschaft wurde als Problem für den Planeten weithin unterschätzt. Und jetzt haben wir hier durch das technische Problem gerade, haben es gemerkt, wir haben ein bisschen gebraucht, bis wir es an den Start gekriegt haben, leider nur die 30-Minuten-Fassung. Dafür haben wir dann anschließend umso mehr Zeit für die Diskussion. Also das ist jetzt eine sehr komprimierte Fassung eines Kinofilms, der 100 Minuten hatte ursprünglich, 10 Milliarden, wie werden wir alle satt? Im WDR-Fernsehen hieß es dann einfach, wie werden wir morgen? Alle sagt, ich starte mal den Film und nachher reden wir weiter.
Lebensmittel. Bei uns in Deutschland gibt es sie im Überfluss. In den Entwicklungsländern herrscht dagegen immer mehr Mangel. Bereits heute hat jeder siebte Mensch auf der Welt zu wenig zu essen und hungert. Dieses Problem verschärft sich, wenn aus den heute 7 Milliarden Menschen im Jahr 2000...
Bei Ihnen am Rechner hier die Lautstärke.
Ist alles angeschlossen?
50 rund 10 Milliarden werden.
Das Kabel hat jetzt übrigens ein Stück. Das ist noch alles.
Laut Agrarindustrie müssten
also, ich würde vorschlagen, angesichts der technischen Situation, hier hat es leider keine Vorbereitung gegeben, was mich ein bisschen enttäuscht, verzichten wir auf die Filmvorführung und steigen direkt in die Diskussion ein. Ja, ich meine, ohne Ton ist der Film sinnlos. Und nein, das ist ja nur der Netzanschluss, das ist noch lange nicht der Ton. Also, ich würde sagen, es macht keinen Sinn. Also, wenn wir jetzt anfangen, hier das Gerät einzurichten. Geht's wieder aus?
Also, macht doch Ton, oder? Wenn wir das Mikro einfach dran geben oder beide?
Das können wir machen.
Das ist eine schlechte Qualität, aber ist doch besser als nichts.
Wir können es mal probieren.
Die Methoden der modernen Landwirtschaft auf den gesamten Planeten ausgeweitet werden.
Aber stimmt das? Sind mehr Chemie und Technik die Lösung?
Wenn Sie das nicht oder wieder, wie bin ich gespannt.
Mach das mal von hinten weiter.
Einer der größten Saatgutkonzerne der Welt ist Bayer. Sollten Erfolgsprodukte gegen den Hunger. Hochleistungspflanzen. Sogenannte Hybride bringen mehr Ertrag als die herkömmlichen Sorten. Bis zu 30%. Lebensmittel. Bei uns in Deutschland gibt es sie im Überfluss. In den Entwicklungsländern herrscht immer mehr Mangel. Bereits heute hat jeder siebte Mensch auf der Welt zu wenig zu essen und hungert. Dieses Problem verschärft sich, wenn aus den heute 7 Milliarden Menschen im Jahr 2050 rund 10 Milliarden werden. Laut Agrarindustrie müssten nur die Methoden der modernen Landwirtschaft auf den gesamten Planeten ausgeweitet werden, um alle zu ernähren. Aber stimmt das? Sind mehr Chemie und Technik die Lebensmittel? Bei uns in Deutschland gibt es sie im Überfluss. In den Entwicklungsländern herrscht dagegen immer mehr Mangel. Bereits heute hat jeder siebte Mensch auf der Welt zu wenig zu essen und hungert. Dieses Problem verschärft sich, wenn aus den heute 7 Milliarden Menschen im Jahr 2050 rund 10 Milliarden werden. Laut Agrarindustrie müssten nur die Methoden der modernen Landwirtschaft auf den gesamten Planeten ausgeweitet werden, um alle zu ernähren. Aber stimmt das? Sind mehr Chemie und Technik die Lösung? Einer der größten Saatgutkonzerne der Welt ist Bayer. Sein Erfolgsprodukt gegen den Hunger: Hochleistungspflanzen. Sogenannte Hybride bringen mehr Ertrag als die herkömmlichen Sorten, bis zu 30%. Ihre Ausbeute soll zukünftig noch höher werden, durch genetische Manipulation. Schon heute hält Bayer mehr Patente auf Genpflanzen als jeder andere Saatgutkonzern auf der Welt.
Unserer Meinung nach kann Gentechnik die Leistung der Pflanzen verbessern.
Gibt es nicht unvorhersehbare Gefahren bei der Gentechnik?
Wenn ich sehe, dass 1 Milliarde Menschen nicht genug zu essen haben, dann denke ich, können wir die Gentechnik nicht ablehnen, nur weil es da vielleicht noch etwas Unklarheit darüber gibt, ob sie nun sicher für die Umwelt ist und ob es vielleicht Langzeitfolgen gibt. Wir sollten möglichst alle Mittel nutzen, die wir haben, um Nahrungsmittel für unsere Gesellschaft zu produzieren.
Mit Saatgut von Konzernen arbeiten weltweit immer mehr Bauern. Heute schon jeder Dritte, Tendenz steigend. Aber die Angst um ihre Ernte ist dennoch geblieben. Die Hybride bringen zwar höhere Erträge, aber nur unter optimalen Bedingungen. Und die werden seltener. So gibt es durch den Klimawandel etwa immer häufiger Überschwemmungen, wie hier im indischen Bundesstaat Odisha.
Die Überschwemmung dauerte 5 Tage.
Aha, noch eine Flutwelle. Und das Wasser blieb 5 Tage?
Ja.
Welche Reissorten hast du?
Swarna.
Swarna, ein Hybridreis. Sind die Hülsen leer? Schau mal nach.
Alles ist zerstört. Nicht ein einziges Korn ist übrig.
Eine Katastrophe für die Bauern. Das Hochleistungssaatgut ist vernichtet. Das traditionelle Saatgut der Bauern hat die Überschwemmung dagegen gut überstanden.
Ich habe für die Pflanzensamen hier fast mütterliche Gefühle. Ich liebe sie, als ob sie meine eigenen Kinder wären. Ich will unser altes Saatgut so lange wie möglich mit Sorgfalt hüten. Wir haben die Samen für unsere Farmer gesammelt. Sie müssen sie jedes Jahr aussehen. Wir können ihnen keine großen Mengen geben. Maximal 500 Gramm, 250 Gramm. Nach der Ernte geben sie uns oft das Doppelte oder Dreifache zurück.
Saatgutbanken wie diese gibt es inzwischen in vielen indischen Dörfern. Denn immer mehr Bauern wollen unabhängig bleiben. Sie behalten lieber ihr eigenes Saatgut. Wenn die Bauern dagegen vom Konzern Saatgut abhängen, müssen sie sich oft verschulden. Für das Saatgut, die dazugehörigen Pestizide und den Kunstdünger. Ohne diese würden die Hochleistungspflanzen verkümmern. Kunstdünger wird unter anderem von der Kali- und Salz AG produziert, dem viertgrößten Düngemittelkonzern der Welt. Wer in den letzten Lagerstätten der Welt Kali abbauen möchte, muss immer tiefer unter die Erde.
In rund 1000 Meter Tiefe befindet sich dieses Bergwerk in Hessen. Für den Forschungsleiter des Konzerns gibt es keine Alternative zu diesen Düngern.
Wir müssen hier die Erträge steigern, das ist klar. Wir haben nicht unbegrenzt Fläche zur Verfügung, beziehungsweise wollen auch aus ökologischen Gründen nicht Fläche in Kultur nehmen. Das heißt, der Weg ist dann nur, die Produktivität, die Flächeneinheit zu steigern.
Ginge das auch ohne Kunstdünger?
Nein. Eine unterlassene Mineraldüngung würde das Hungerproblem deutlich verschärfen, weil die Erträge zurückgehen würden. Das sieht man ja auch im ökologischen Landbau, die deutlich geringere Erträge haben. Und wenn ich gänzlich auf Mineraldünger verzichten würde, würde das das Hungerproblem natürlich enorm verschärfen. Die Geschichte hier vor Ort wird sicher noch einige Jahrzehnte uns ermöglichen, hier Düngemittel zu produzieren.
Was schätzen Sie ungefähr?
Das bin ich nicht der Experte, der das sagen kann, aber ich denke, so 40 bis 50 Jahre wird das sicher noch sein.
Dann ist ja Ende.
Ja.
Die Abfälle des Kali-Bergbaus lagern auf einer riesigen Halde. Sie wird noch hier sein, lange nachdem die Kali-Vorräte zu Ende gegangen sein werden. Kali ist für das Pflanzenwachstum unverzichtbar und lässt sich durch nichts ersetzen. Das gilt auch für Phosphat, dessen weltweite Vorräte sogar schon in 50 Jahren zur Neige gehen. Wir stehen schon bald am Ende des Kunstdüngerzeitalters. Als Lösung gegen den Hunger in der Welt taugt die Turbolandwirtschaft also allenfalls kurzfristig. Viel Dünger braucht auch der großflächige Anbau von Soja. Jetzt werden immer mehr solcher Monokulturen auch hier in Afrika aufgezogen. Unter anderem von Investoren aus den USA wie Jess Tarp.
Das ist wunderschön.
This is beautiful. This is beautiful.
Fantastisch.
So don't shake too much. Just leave me that. This is just incredible.
Es ist kaum zu glauben, wenn man sich klar macht, dass das vor zwei Jahren so aussah wie dort drüben. Und jetzt schaut es so aus. Das ist aufregend. Die Frucht der eigenen Arbeit.
It's the fruit of one's labor.
Jess Tarp ist gerade mal seit zwei Jahren hier in Mosambik. Er hofft, seine Ernte bald nach Übersee zu exportieren. Deutschland ist einer der größten Abnehmer. Soja wird als Futter in der Massentierhaltung verwendet. In Deutschland würden die Äcker gar nicht reichen. Das Soja, das wir importieren, wird auf einer Fläche angebaut, die so groß ist wie ganz Nordrhein-Westfalen. Davon profitieren in erster Linie Kapitalgesellschaften. Für die Einheimischen bleiben vor allem Tagelöhnerjobs. Lohn 2 Euro am Tag.
Wir müssen die Unkräuter von Hand rausholen, weil wir bei dem nassen Wetter nicht spritzen können. Du musst sicherstellen, dass das ordentlich erledigt wird. Ich habe saubere Vorarbeiter satt. Wir brauchen schmutzige Vorarbeiter. Diese Arbeitskultur muss sich ändern. Wenn die Landwirtschaft erfolgreich sein will, müssen sie verstehen, dass es keinen Unterschied macht, ob du der Boss bist oder der Arbeiter. Alle müssen schmutzig werden. Und wenn du nicht schmutzig werden willst, dann hau ab.
Das größte Problem aber ist, der Anbau von Futtermitteln für Deutschland belegt Felder, die dringend gebraucht werden, um Nahrung für Menschen anzubauen. Die meisten Sojafarmen in Afrika werden rücksichtslos auf Kleinbauernland errichtet. Mit Bulldozern werden die Hütten und Gärten plattgewalzt. Die Kleinbauern können sich meist nicht wehren, weil die Großfarmer von korrupten Politikern unterstützt werden. Die weltweit steigende Nachfrage nach Soja als Tierfutter verschärft daher das Hungerproblem. Der Wunsch nach Fleisch erfasst auch Länder wie Indien, die bisher weitgehend vegetarisch lebten. Bislang leben 40% der Inder fleischlos, eine uralte Tradition. Doch seit einigen Jahren brechen viele Inder damit. Die Hühnerfarmen boomen, und zwar in Form von Massentierhaltung, wie wir sie aus Norddeutschland kennen. Und dort her stammen auch die Großeltern dieser Küken. Vom Wess-Johann-Konzern, der auch die Wiesenhofhühnchen produziert. Die Inder haben ihn bei der Zahl der produzierten Hühnchen bereits überholt.
Wir
Wir produzieren 7 Millionen Hühnchen pro Woche. Damit sind wir weltweit an 10. Stelle. In Indien sind wir die Nummer 1. Wir sind die führenden Hühnerproduzenten seit 8 bis 10 Jahren. Als wir vor 25 Jahren begannen, war es schwierig, auch nur 10 oder 20 Hühnchen zu verkaufen. Heute produzieren wir rund 1 Million Hühnchen am Tag und wir verkaufen alle. Die Nachfrage steigt und steigt. Ich hoffe, dieses Wachstum setzt sich in den nächsten 25 Jahren fort.
Mehr Fleisch aus der Massentierhaltung heißt mehr Tierfutter. Bereits heute wird ein Drittel der globalen Getreideernte an Tiere verfüttert. Und das in einer Zeit, in der weltweit die Ackerflächen schrumpfen. Die verbleibenden Felder werden dringend für die Ernährung von Menschen benötigt. Findet die Wissenschaft neue technische Lösungen, die die Menschheit unabhängig vom knappen Boden machen kann? Liegt die Zukunft in solchen Pflanzenfabriken, von denen es in Japan bereits 250 gibt?
In der Fabrik automatisieren wir die Arbeit, damit wir so wenig Menschen wie möglich benötigen. Wir wollen keine Pestizide verwenden. Deshalb wollen wir nichts hineinlassen, was eine Kontamination verursachen kann. Menschen würden das Risiko erhöhen. Deshalb müssen wir die Fabrik automatisieren.
Unsere Produkte sind unübertroffen. Die Produktivität der Pflanzenfabrik ist 100-mal so groß wie beim Feldanbau. Auf dem Feld kann man nur 1 oder 2 Mal pro Jahr ernten. Hier in der Pflanzenfabrik wird 9-mal pro Jahr geerntet. Außerdem können wir auf mehreren Etagen anbauen. Bis zu 16 Etagen sind möglich. Deshalb können wir das 100-fache auf der gleichen Anbaufläche produzieren.
Ohne Erde herangewachsen, makellos, bakterienfrei. Der Salat muss nicht mehr gewaschen werden.
Erde ist kein kontrollierbares Medium. Deshalb wollen wir sie nicht benutzen. Unkontrollierbares ist das Schlimmste. Hier in der Fabrik muss alles kontrollierbar sein. In der Erde wachsen auf jeden Fall Bakterien. Diese wären für uns ein Problem. Deshalb verwenden wir auf keinen Fall Erde.
Der Strom für die Beleuchtung ist teuer. Trotzdem in Japan ein lohnendes Geschäft. Denn das Ackerland hier ist knapp. Die Lebensmittelpreise sind hoch. Eine Lösung nur für reiche Länder. Für die Armen der Welt ist das schlicht zu teuer. Auch beim Fleisch werden Alternativen zur herkömmlichen Tierhaltung entwickelt. Vorreiter ist das Labor der niederländischen Universität Maastricht.
Ich würde es noch nicht wirklich als Fleisch bezeichnen. Erst dann, wenn es nicht mehr zu unterscheiden ist von richtigem Fleisch. Wenn Sie Leute in einem Blindversuch damit täuschen können. Es ist sehr einfach. Wir entnehmen durch eine kleine Spritze der Kuh einige Stammzellen. Sie haben die Fähigkeit, sich zu teilen. In einem oder 2 Tagen wird dieser Behälter voll mit Zellen sein. Aus einer Stammzelle können wir einige Milliarden Stammzellen erzeugen und daraus rund 10.000 Kilo Fleisch herstellen. Für einen Hamburger brauchen wir ungefähr 20.000 von diesen kleinen Ringen. Beim Reden habe ich es fast anbrennen lassen. Dieser Hamburger hat 250.000 Euro gekostet. Die Kosten werden bald sinken, bereits mit der aktuellen Produktionsmethode. Wenn wir diese verbessern, dann wird es in 10 bis 15 Jahren wahrscheinlich billiger als normales Fleisch sein.
In 10, 15 years it will probably be cheaper than regular meat. Tastes good.
Schmeckt gut. Es ist noch nicht perfekt, aber wir kommen dahin.
Noch wird das Laborfleisch nur von Wissenschaftlern genossen. Wird es bald auch von Verbrauchern gegessen? Vorteil, in Entwicklungsländern müsste weniger Soja angebaut werden. Aber als Hilfe für die Hungernden sind die künstlichen Burger zu teuer. Sie verbrauchen zu viel Kapital und Energie. Arme Menschen können sich nur dann Lebensmittel leisten, wenn die Methoden einfacher werden. Low-Tech statt High-Tech. Wie dies aussehen kann? In der amerikanischen Großstadt Milwaukee nutzt der Basketballstar Will Allen Brachflächen in einem Armenviertel.
Wir haben eine Ernährungskrise in der Welt. Auch in den USA gehen 3 von 10 Kindern ohne Essen zu Bett. Wir haben eine weltweite Krise, weil viele Menschen nicht an jedem Tag gutes Essen bekommen können. Und wenn ich sage, gutes Essen, dann meine ich nicht einfach Essen, sondern gutes Essen. Gutes Essen wird von einer Sache erzeugt. Gutem Boden.
That's what it's all about.
Die Würmer vergrößern die biologische Aktivität im Boden um das 14-fache. Wir starteten vor ein paar Jahren mit 30 Pfund Würmern und heute haben wir allein in dieser Farm 7000 Pfund. Ich sagte gerade, wir haben 140 Angestellte, aber in Wirklichkeit sind es 140 Milliarden Angestellte. Ich mag diese Angestellten wirklich, weil sie dir nie wieder Worte geben oder komisch zurückschauen, wenn du ihnen etwas erzählst, wie es Menschen manchmal tun. Beim Weitergehen könnt ihr gerne mal in den Boden greifen und fühlen. Das ist Gewächshaus Nummer 2, unser erstes großes Aquaponics-System, eine Art Pflanzenkraftwerk. Die Ausscheidungen der Fische werden von den Pflanzen aufgenommen. Das ist wichtig, weil diese Abfallstoffe im Wasser in Nitrit umgewandelt werden, giftig für die Fische. Einige dieser Stickstoffverbindungen lagern sich in den Seitenwänden oder im Kiesboden ab, aber das meiste wird von den Wurzeln der Pflanzen aufgenommen, sodass die Fische überleben können.
Das Aquaponik-System lebt von einem eigenständigen Nährstoffkreislauf. Es kombiniert Fisch- und Pflanzenzucht. Die Abfallstoffe der Fische dienen als Dünger und die Pflanzenreste als Fischfutter. Geeignet für kleine Einheiten und dennoch hochproduktiv. Studien aus aller Welt belegen, Kleinbauern schöpfen aus einem Hektar Land mehr Ertrag als Großfarmer. Für Afrika bedeutet dies sehr viel, wie hier im dicht besiedelten Malawi.
Es war katastrophal. Hier im Dorf hungerten viele Familien. Wir bauten damals noch kein Gemüse an. Wir aßen vor allem Mais. Gemüse aus dem Garten galt als etwas Exotisches für Weiße. Wir begannen erst vor rund 10 Jahren damit, selbst Gemüsefelder anzulegen. Weil die Gärten so klein sind, pflanzen wir auch verschiedenes Gemüse nebeneinander. Damit können wir nicht nur mehr anbauen, sondern haben auch mehr Sicherheit. Wenn die Ernte bei einer Sorte schlecht ausfällt, ist sie bei einer anderen vielleicht besser. Zum Beispiel hatten wir eine gute Hirseernte, aber unsere Straucherbsen tragen nicht gut. Dieses Jahr werden wir nur wenig ernten. Doch wenn eine Kultur misslingt, klappt wenigstens die andere.
Die Kleinbauern in den Entwicklungsländern können sich oft weder Dünger noch Pestizide leisten. Aber wie kommt es dann, dass Sie so viel ernten? Das verdanken Sie Ihrer Arbeit per Hand. So können Sie die Felder sehr viel intensiver bewirtschaften und unterschiedliche Nutzpflanzen nebeneinander auf einem Feld anbauen. Mit Maschinen geht das nicht, nur von Menschenhand. Großfarmen dagegen möchten mit Technik und Chemie Arbeitskräfte einsparen. Hier ist das gar kein Vorteil, denn Lohnarbeiter gibt es mehr als genug.
Man soll Gemüse essen, um gesund zu bleiben. Früher hatten wir im Dorf immer 10 bis 15 unterernährte Kinder. Heute sind es nur noch 2 oder 3. Und die sind vor allem deshalb unterernährt, weil sie vorher schon krank waren.
Vor 15 Jahren kamen nach einer Hungerkrise deutsche Entwicklungshelfer ins Dorf. Sie haben den Anbau von Gemüse eingeführt, weil viele Menschen fehlernährt waren. Davor hatten die Dorfbewohner ihren Vitaminbedarf durch Wildpflanzen gedeckt, die sie im Wald sammelten. Doch der Wald ist längst abgeholzt. Umso wichtiger die eigene Ernte. Das betrifft aber auch die Grundversorgung mit Getreide. Die Preise auf dem Weltmarkt schwanken derart, dass die Kleinbauern nur eine Chance haben. Möglichst viel davon selbst zu erzeugen.
Wir hatten dieses Jahr eine magere Ernte. Nur noch 9 Maissäcke sind übrig. Früher war so eine Situation gleich eine Katastrophe. Aber heute kann ich ausweichen. Ich habe noch ein Feld mit Maniok und Süßkartoffeln. Das kann ich kombinieren mit dem Mais.
Dort, wo sich Großfarmen breitmachen, sind Kleinbauern wie Fanny gefährdet. Dabei sind gerade sie das Rückgrat der Welternährung. Denn über 2/3 der Menschheit werden von Kleinbauern ernährt. Wenn die Agrarindustrie irgendwo auf der Welt die Produktion steigert, bringt es armen Menschen nichts. Ihnen fehlt schlicht die Kaufkraft. Sie können sich diese Lebensmittel nicht leisten. Besser ist es, sie werden dezentral erzeugt und von denjenigen, die sie selbst brauchen. Dann werden auch die Einkünfte sozial ausgewogen verteilt. In den Entwicklungsländern versorgen sich Menschen sogar in riesigen Megacities von 10 Millionen und mehr Einwohnern mit regionalen Lebensmitteln. In der dritten Welt ernährt die urbane Landwirtschaft viele Menschen. Und in der ersten Welt? Werden wir lernen, unser Essen mehr wertzuschätzen? In der nordenglischen Stadt Todmorden versucht dies eine Bürgerinitiative. Sie hat die ganze Stadt zum Garten für alle erklärt.
Hier brauche ich ein Loch und rundherum Erde. Toll, du hast zuvor noch nie gegärtnet. Stell sicher, dass hier keiner was kaputt macht. Das ist jetzt dein Busch. Wenn du eine Aktion starten willst, dann am besten mit deinen eigenen Händen, deinem eigenen Geld und deinem eigenen Platz. Wir begannen in unseren Gärten und dann nahmen wir die der Stadtverwaltung. Wir besitzen die öffentlichen Flächen, um die sich niemand kümmert, und legen dort Gärten an. Hier war alles mit großen Bäumen bepflanzt, die im Lastwagen hergebracht wurden. 25.000 Euro teure Architektenpflanzen. Stachlig, grün, giftig, nicht essbar. Ich ging zum Chefarzt und fragte: Doktor, sollen Ihre Patienten beim Reingehen Äpfel pflücken und beim Rausgehen Rhabarber? Er sagte: Tolle Idee, aber wir können nicht dafür zahlen. Also haben wir Geld gesammelt, die Genehmigung eingeholt und die ganzen Zierpflanzen rausgeholt. Alles, was Sie jetzt sehen, ist essbar.
die Guerillagärtner bepflanzen Bürgersteige, Parkplätze und Bahnsteige. Und jeder kann an der Ernte teilhaben.
Ganz ehrlich, ich war am Anfang etwas skeptisch. Ich dachte, dass Leute die Anlagen verwüsten, aber das ist nicht passiert. Es sieht ganz so aus, als ob es funktioniert. Wir helfen, indem wir die Pflanzen bewässern. So können die Bürger auch leichter Kontakt mit der Polizei aufnehmen. So trauen sie sich, mit uns zu reden. Das hilft der Gemeinschaft hier im Tal, ganz ehrlich.
Ich denke, bald ist die Kacke am Dampfen. Wir werden eine Ernährungskrise in der Welt haben. Vor 5 Jahren kam eine Aschewolke von einem Vulkan in Island. Die Flugzeuge durften nicht mehr nach England fliegen. Wir waren nur 4 Tage von einer Ernährungskrise entfernt, als die Flugzeuge endlich wieder fliegen durften. Es ist beinahe passiert, nur wegen einem Vulkan in Island. Das kann ganz leicht passieren.
England produziert nur noch 60% des eigenen Bedarfs und auch andere europäische Länder hängen zunehmend von Importen ab.
Viele Leute sagen jetzt, lasst uns eine essbare Landschaft machen. Wenn ich 80 bin und die Straße hinuntergehe und Erdbeeren und Äpfel pflücken kann und alle machen das, das würde mich glücklich machen. Das wäre so schön.
Für das riesige Problem der Welternährung gibt es keine einfachen, großen Lösungen, sondern viele kleine, lokale. In Europa ebenso wie in den Entwicklungsländern. Die industrielle Turbolandwirtschaft hilft den Hungernden nicht. Ganz im Gegenteil. Die Großfarmen vertreiben die Kleinbauern von ihrem Land. Für Kleinbauern ist es vorteilhaft, ihre Grundversorgung selbst zu erzeugen. Dann werden auch die Einkünfte gerechter verteilt. Ihre Ernteüberschüsse liefern sie in die Städte. Nur so wird es möglich sein, dass auch in Zukunft 10 Milliarden Menschen satt werden.
Ja, dankeschön. Schön, dass es geklappt hat. Ich dachte schon, ich muss hier das Motto eines meiner nächsten Filme verkünden. Shit Happens wird das heißen. Und wird auch mit dem Thema zu tun haben, weil eigentlich einen richtigen Kreislauf in der Landwirtschaft kriegen wir ja nur hin, wenn wir auch unsere Ausscheidungen auf den Acker tragen. Da sind wir noch weit weg davon, aber das wird die einzige Möglichkeit sein, um das, was in dem Film kurz angesprochen wird, also dass die Phosphor- und Kaliminen in den nächsten 100 Jahren erschöpft sein werden, um da andere Quellen zu finden, weil Pflanzen brauchen eigentlich alle Nährstoffe und zwar die anderen, die sind noch ein bisschen länger verfügbar und Phosphor, wenn das aus ist, dann müssen wir recyceln. Da gibt es gar keinen anderen Weg, weil die Pflanzen wachsen nicht ohne Phosphor. Das wird ein Engpass sein. Ja, ich will nur noch kurz erzählen, wie es von diesem Film zum Kölner Ernährungsrat kam. Und dann will ich auch schon unsere Gäste aus Kanada, Brasilien, USA einladen. Und ich hoffe inzwischen auch aus England. England ist auch da super, wunderbar, willkommen. Also wir hatten zum Beispiel auch, das ist jetzt in der Kurzfassung nicht drin, auch ein schönes Beispiel aus Kanada, genetisch veränderte Lachse. Das war auch so, das ist glaube ich nicht untypisch. Auch die sind fester Meinung, das ist eine Lösung für den Welthunger. So wie das Laborfleisch und dabei sind es eigentlich alles Lösungen, die für die reichen Länder konzipiert wurden. Es ist jetzt vielleicht nicht so, dass man sofort sagen kann, Wahnsinn oder nicht Wahnsinn. Gut, bei Gentechnik sind wir uns hier wahrscheinlich einig, aber andere Lösungen würde ich gar nicht sagen, dass die nicht in irgendwelchen, der Salat, Indoor-Salat macht vielleicht in Sibirien oder in den Arabischen Emiraten Sinn, wo es mit Wasser oder mit Kälte ein Problem gibt. Aber es ist irrelevant für die Welternährung. Und auch wenn sie gerne diese Lösungen verkaufen, also das hat, glaube ich, man kann, glaube ich, sagen, all diejenigen, die sagen, wir haben die Lösung für die Welternährung, ja, da muss man geschäftliches Interesse vermuten, weil es ist so vielgestaltig auf der Welt, dass man nicht von einer Lösung sprechen kann. Und wir haben uns überlegt, also ich und ein paar Freunde, können wir dazu was beitragen und haben damals einen Verein gegründet, der hieß oder heißt immer noch Taste of Heimat. Also man sieht schon, hat ein bisschen was mit Taste the Waste zu tun und dann spielt er natürlich auch mit diesem politisch gerne missbrauchten Heimatbegriff. Damals waren schon fast die Hälfte der Gründungsmitglieder waren Landwirte und wir haben damals überlegt, was können wir denn tun, um wieder ein regionales Ernährungssystem zu unterstützen, waren zunächst mal bei einer Webseite, wo wir regionale Erzeuger mit den Städtern und das war uns alles nicht genug. Das reichte uns nicht und wir haben daraufhin ein bisschen uns umgeschaut, was gibt es für Lösungen anderswo auf der Welt und sind auf das Konzept der Food Policy Councils gestoßen. Das ist, wir haben es dann mehr schlecht als recht Ernährungsrat genannt, aber ich glaube, im Deutschen muss man erst noch etwas finden, was das wirklich so schön zusammenfasst wie im Englischen. Das ist halt eben eine andere Sprache mit anderen. Aber ich glaube, wenn ein Begriff erstmal eingeführt ist dann, und Menschen etwas damit verbinden, dann wird er auch eingeführt. Aber was in England, Brasilien, Kanada und USA für eine Erfahrung mit Ernährungsräten. Da ist dazu, werden wir gleich ein bisschen mehr hören. Lena, du wirst die Diskussion leiten. Bitte, ich übergebe jetzt an dich.
Wir machen jetzt noch einen kleinen Umbau, oder?
Machen wir erstmal einen Umbau. Brauchen wir viel Umbau? Ich klappe meinen Laptop zu und dann können wir direkt starten. Mach du das, wie du willst. Genau. Du sagst es.
Ich sage nur gleich schon mal vorweg, also während wir hier den kurzen Umbau machen mit den Stühlen, damit wir alle hier vorne Platz haben, eine wichtige Frage. Wir wollen die Diskussion gleich auf Englisch führen, einfach damit das einfacher ist für die Referenten, die ja zum Großteil Englisch sprechen und eben kein Deutsch. Und dann sind wir hier auf dem Panel, machen wir einheitlich Englisch. Deshalb die wichtige Frage, wer versteht unter euch und Ihnen kein Englisch. Also sprechen ist doch okay, wenn es Fragen gibt, die können auch auf Deutsch gestellt werden, das ist kein Problem. Aber wer würde jetzt der Diskussion nicht folgen können auf Englisch? Bitte mal die Hand heben, weil dann könnten wir die so ein bisschen clustern. Okay, hier vorne. Da ist auch noch so ein bisschen. Gut. Könntet ihr euch vielleicht so ein bisschen zusammensetzen? Und dann haben wir da hinten die Dolmetscherin, die gerade noch beschäftigt ist mit den Referenten und die würde dann zu euch kommen und so ein bisschen euch unterstützen. Oder so, oder so. Wunderbar. Also da hinten ist die Juliane für dann gleich deutsche Übersetzung. Bitte nach hinten. Genau, und dann bauen wir hier kurz nur um. Reicht vielleicht, wenn jemand mal schnell auf Toilette möchte, aber wir machen keine große Pause.
Ja, die Kabel sind hier so ein bisschen. Guckst du einmal kurz, wie weit die Kabel? Ja, aber.
Hätte dein Besteck.
Ach, das ist bestimmt, das hört sich. Normalerweise könnte ich das auf jeden Fall. Das Problem ist, es ist keine Person mehr hier im Haus. Das wäre. Ich habe keinen Generalschlüssel für den Technikraum. Warte mal, aber ich gucke nochmal auf die Jelda. Die könnte vielleicht.
Ja, so. Braucht ihr noch was? Also mir scheint es, dass es jetzt einen geregelten Gang geht. Ich hätte mir noch nie vor, dass gleich umgehen muss, aber das kann ich auch machen. Wenn die gleich dann entsprechend durch sind, sollen die Fragen aus dem Publikum genommen werden.
Yeah, that's true. We might like mix female male a little bit. So like if both of us were sitting here, it would be like green or district. So yeah, perfect. I can sit here. That's perfect.
That was actually was the condition.
I just thought
what's really successful such a complex topic, but people really want to know about that.
I know, I'm the same, yeah. So we'll probably grab each other. Or is that yours? Is the
box?
Okay. Yeah,
that's
okay.
Ja, okay.
Hallo? Does it work?
Aber es ist ziemlich leise, oder?
Ah, schon. Was? Hello? Yeah, perfect. So I think we're going to start. Welcome back. So again, just to present myself briefly, my name is Lena Michelsen. I work for the German Development Cooperation Network in COTA, based in Berlin. And in COTA is also co-organizer of this event tonight, not the whole weekend, but at least tonight. So good evening from myself, for my part as well. I want to present you first our very interesting and very international panel. I have here, to my side, Wayne Roberts, Mark Winne, Christine Pohl, Bruno Prado, Leon Balin, and Valentin Chun. You already know him. Okay, so I would briefly have like a round of questions, like just on the panel, and then we want to open up the panel for your questions, for your comments, and everything is welcome. And as I already said, you can raise questions in German or in English, both as possible. We can translate here on the panel. So let's start with Wayne Roberts. Wayne is a food policy analyst and a writer. And he managed the Toronto Food Policy Council for 10 years, is that correct? So, Wayne, what was the whole idea behind the Food Policy Council in Toronto? How did it come into being?
Well, I think the Toronto Food Policy Council, like most of the councils in North America, began because of a problem of hunger in our own cities, which I think is not an experience that has been anywhere near as profound in Europe or in Germany. But that was the founding issue. And I guess the point about it is that it made food relevant to cities for the first time. Generally, cities have been in charge of three things, pavement, parks, and police. And food was not one of their areas, and all of a sudden hunger, which hit hardest in the cities or in urban areas, made it a city issue, and cities were not very comfortable with it. And it happened in the case of Toronto that we have a public health department, which is very prominent in the city, a very important part of the functioning of the city. And they were in the 1980s, which is about the time when hunger first really became a big public issue in North America, discovering the social determinants of health. And we're working very closely with the World Health Organization in Switzerland. And the combination of the two and a few experiments in a number of relatively small American cities led people to discover this idea of a food policy council. And I think what makes the food policy council distinctive in today's world is that there's two questions that you can really ask about food in cities. And the first is, what can cities do for food? And if you think about the Milan Pact, it's essentially a long list of things that cities can do for food. It's basically, however, the same list as the Food and Agriculture Organization has. But these are things that cities should take on themselves. And I think that's a very important thing to ask, and it's really the beginning of awareness in cities, is that cities see themselves as playing a role beyond parks, police, and pavement, and dealing with the biggest issues of the world, including global warming. But the second question is the one I think is most relevant for food policy councils, and that is, what does food do for cities? And when we understand that, then I think we ask very different things of what a city can do that have never been addressed by national governments. And I call that people-centered food policy. That is, what does food do to help bring people together, to help create enjoyable places, to help create a sense of place in community, to help bring city people in connection with rural people so we have an understanding of each other. And that is the range of issues. So you could say, in a sense, there's, I think one reason why governments have never understood food, if you have ever tried to answer a Rubik's or deal with a Rubik's Cube, you understand that you can only solve the Rubik's Cube on all six sides at the same time. You can't solve that problem one side at a time. And for governments, I think that has been very difficult for them to deal with anything that has a Rubik's Cube proportions to it. And so the reality of food, I think its six sides are health, economy, and environment, which I believe are fundamentally issues for national and subnational levels of government. And the last three issues are culture, community, and people. And I believe those are fundamentally city-based and city-centered activities. So to me, the exciting thing about food policy councils is we can deal with half of the food picture, which has never been dealt with adequately before. And I might say the most interesting thing about this gathering to me is that because food policy councils are deal primarily with local governments and are very oriented towards local realities, to the best of my knowledge, this is the first meeting that I'm aware of that's ever dealt with food policy councils on a national level. So welcome to the first of those meetings.
Thanks so much, Wayne, for your input. Very interesting. My next question I would like to raise to Bruno. Bruno Prado is a member of the Council for Food Security in Rio de Janeiro in Brazil and the Reference Center on Food and Nutrition Sovereignty and Security. And Bruno, I would like to know, since Rio de Janeiro is such a mega city, what kind of challenges do you face there, like when it comes to food policy? And what role does urban farming, urban gardening play?
Yeah, I think Wayne has started the discussion on what is the role, the connections between food and cities, and this for us in Rio de Janeiro is a very important issue in the sense that, you have, Rio de Janeiro is a 6 million city, inhabitants, with 6 million inhabitant city, and its metropolitan region has around 12 million people. And it has been through a huge process of urbanization in the last few years. So you have had many areas that have been always belonging to rural families or family farmers, and that the urban dynamics have arrived in those regions. So what we call today urban agriculture in Rio many times are these experiences of peri-urban agriculture. So you have families that have been there for a long time that have an important knowledge on farming, but that are not recognized as farmers anymore because they are in the urban areas, even though the urban areas arrived or turned out to be urban after they were already there. So I think to be able to affirm that there are possibilities to have agriculture or to have experiences of farming in the city, in the context of the Brazilian metropolis, such as Rio, for example, was one of the important aspects for the councils, for the what we call in Brazil the Food and Nutrition Security Councils, because it's been a place where farmers and the organizations that are working with them could gather to demand that they were recognized, that they were recognized as farmers, and that they could access public policies for family farming, for example. So this in a small example of the role of the councils in a city like Rio de Janeiro. Yes.
And could you also briefly say, like, I think we all know about difficult political situation in Brazil at the moment, especially for civil society organizations. How has your work changed in the last couple of years within in this area, particular area of like food policy?
Yeah, the councils in Brazil have been the place or the forums where civil society organizations were able to have a voice to be heard from the government. They were able to participate for the first time after the military dictatorship in formulating public policies or letting the government know how public policies could be better designed to have the target most accurately, I'd say. Well, in the last few years, since you have a difficult political moment right now in Brazil, we don't yet know how these councils that have the status of advisors to the presidency or to the local governments, how they will keep on being heard by the politicians. But even if the difficulties in these connections of civil society and government remain, I think they are the place where civil society organizations are getting strengthened, and it is the place where they are being able to discuss public policies and in this context. Yeah.
Thank you so much. I would like to come back next to Mark Winner. Mark is a co-founder of numerous food policy groups in Connecticut, USA. And he's actually currently working as a writer and a consultant as well. So I would like to know, Mark, what are the key pieces of advice you would give to people that want to influence food policy on a local basis from your experience?
Okay, I also work across the United States, and we have our difficult political moment too right now, but started just a little over a year ago, which, besides its rather serious consequences, has put more onus, I believe, on the cities across the U.S. to pick up on some of the work that we find our federal government not paying attention to. And food, of course, is one. And I think, you know, Wayne has made a very good point about what the functions of cities are becoming with respect to food. My favorite quote is from a colleague who once said that given how important food is everywhere, it's ironic that there is no Department of Food in any city in the U.S., nor is there any Department of Food at any of our 50 states. And we even refuse to name our national food agency, which is the U.S. Department of Agriculture. We refuse to put food in that. Nevertheless, food has become so important that we now have 250 food policy councils in the U.S. About 20 to 30 of those are at the state level. The rest are local. Approximately 25 cities, and those are probably your larger ones, New York, Los Angeles, Chicago, have full-time or a full-time staff working on food issues. And this is very new. I mean, it is a very strong and new trend to have this much interest at the local level in food. And I think it's complex as to its origins, but I think it has a lot to do with the increase in just the overall increase in the interest of food. It's not food policy so much as it is the fact that, you know, there are so many connections and a growing awareness, a growing food consciousness that, you know, food is related to health, food is related to the environment, food is related to our economy. It is such a, it is really the connector, it's the hub in so many facets of our lives. And we've found over the years, have found expression for that in farmers markets, 8,500 farmers markets now in the U.S., community gardens, many, many forms of connecting once again to local food, local agriculture, recognizing finally that food makes an enormous contribution to the economy of a local area. And in fact, much more can be done to cultivate the economic power of food. And it's each one of these little dots, each one of these little pieces of the so-called food system that people are understanding, and they're making those connections. And so they inevitably ask the question, why isn't local government more involved? You know, it's like Wayne says, you know, they used to just police and put down pavements and so forth. Now we have literally hundreds of cities that are passing laws, regulations, ordinances. They're changing their zoning to accommodate urban agriculture. They're making way for farmers markets. I mean, it's if a city in the U.S. of any size doesn't have a farmers market by now, it's laughed at. I mean, it's not even considered a city if it doesn't have a farmers market. If you don't have a place to go on Saturday morning with your cup of coffee and your nice bag to buy some fresh organic vegetables, you feel very inferior. So it's now just become a fact of life. And inevitably, as I said, cities will become involved. The mayors are tripping over themselves to make sure that they are considered a food mayor. Our other elected officials. We actually have candidate nights when, before an election, a local election, people will ask them questions about their positions on food and food issues. So the action, you might say, is at the local level right now, and inevitably that translates into more public policy, and it translates into more robust food policy councils, and ultimately it translates into a much healthier community overall.
Thanks so much, Mark. So Leon Bolin is over there. Leon is the manager of the Sustainable Food Cities Network and Soil Association in the UK. And Leon, we already saw in the film that there are many initiatives in the UK concerned with food and on a local basis, right? So what would you say, what is the main driver behind all these initiatives?
Well, it was great to see Todmorden on, which is just up the road from me. I live in Sheffield. So I'm here to represent Sustainable Food Cities as a national network, but also I'm involved with a local food partnership in Sheffield where I live, which is a post-industrial city trying to find an identity. It's very cold, very wet. It's not dissimilar to Essen. So I feel quite at home here. And it's in Yorkshire, and Todmorden's in Yorkshire as well. And the driver in Yorkshire, I mean, what drives a lot of these programmes is people not seeing what they want happen. There's usually one or two very committed, very passionate people who start something in their town or city. And then usually it's an idea. And the thing about Incredible Edible in Todmorden is it's just an idea. They don't own a brand. They can support other places that want to develop something similar to that with urban food growing. In Sheffield, there was a programme that wasn't their idea, but it was called Abundance, which is the idea of collecting unwanted fruit and then distributing it for free. And these are just ideas. And they're the ones that seem to work best because they become a movement and they're not owned by anyone. So that's the driver for, I think, those kind of ideas. But prices have changed in Britain quite a lot, and the driver for a lot of grassroots food activity at the moment is food poverty, or as we probably would like to call it, lack of food sovereignty. And that's been an issue since austerity. 2010, since the crash. So those are big drivers. And then alongside that, the drivers for a lot of activity in Britain at the moment is public health. So, you know, the increasing health problems associated with industrialised food system, obesity, diabetes, all those things that I'm sure a lot of us know about. So there's a potential alliance there between local government, public health, and community activists. Would it be helpful if I talk a little bit about sustainable food cities? So I'll just say something about Sheffield, actually, because I'm involved nationally with sustainable food cities, but I'm also involved with a food policy council or food partnership, as we sometimes call them, inspired by food policy councils, in Sheffield. And it is very much like Essen, the city. And we were told, I remember somebody saying a long time ago, you'll never have a local food system there. It's the wrong type of, the soil's wrong, the environment's wrong, the climate's wrong. Well, that's happening now. We're developing scaled-up urban food growing into market gardens. That translate well? It's sort of small food growing. We used to call it market gardens. All British cities used to be surrounded by what they called market gardens that fed the cities. That went away. And now it's happening again. So I would say to anyone from Essen or a city similar to this, if anyone says you can't do it here, well, you can, because we're already doing it in Sheffield. But Sustainable Food Cities was founded about 5 years ago by three organisations. So we're our partnership. We're not just the Soil Association. And the Soil Association is the is organic food inspector in Britain. And then there's Food Matters, who are a food policy development organisation based in Brighton. And then there's Sustain, who are a food campaigning organisation based in London. And the three organisations were aware that there was lots of interesting food activity happening, food policy council type activity. Bristol and Brighton were the two areas that were leading the way. And it was thought, how could these places be supported? So that's what we do nationally. We support food policy councils in towns and cities across the UK because we were aware that really the energy and the food activists and the passion and the experts were already in the towns and cities, but with a little bit of support, because a small amount of support to community organisations can make a big difference. So that's our role, really, is to do that. And we found that really the best way to support those places is to help them bring people together. So we're very much into, again, like food policy councils, the idea of partnership. So local government, public sector, the community sector and the business sector, and then that kind of cocktail effect when people get together that good things happen. So that's really... So the drivers in... To answer your question, the drivers in Britain are changing all the time for food activism. It used to be the environment, now it's food poverty. And between that, there was public health in between. So it's changing all the time, really.
Okay, thanks so much. So now we're sort of coming back to the audience's local level, namely Germany, Christine. you're a co-founder of the Berlin Food Policy Council. And can you name some particular reasons, like for the founding of the Food Policy Council in Berlin, particularly? And also, like another interesting question I want to raise is how can food policy councils also address social problems, maybe social inequities?
I think in Berlin, or in Germany in general, I think it's true that maybe food poverty and hunger are not so much the driving concerns behind initiating food policy councils. But I think what, at least in Berlin, we had in mind, or as an international context maybe, was the whole thing. What we have also seen in the film is the question of how can we have a food system, a local food system, that does not have the negative impacts that our current food system has worldwide. So at the moment, we are relying on a food system that has negative impacts, exploiting resources worldwide, violating human rights worldwide. And how can we get away from that system? And how can we get to a system that is more just on a global level, But at the same time, it's not only, well, it's not that we don't have food poverty at all. There's also the question of social justice or of justice at the local level, because we compared to all the other countries sitting here, I think we have a quite reliable social security system and social welfare system in Germany. But still, there is a lot of there's a lot of people who actually rely heavily on the cheap industrial food that this global food system brings into the cities, and who can only afford their food because they can buy it cheaply in discounters. And we have in Berlin a very, I think, quite a broad and progressive food startup scene with a lot of initiatives and projects that try to do it differently, that try to already move into the future and create a food system that works better for the environment, for justice, for local farmers, for everyone, basically. But the people who can actually use it normally are actually the ones who can buy in market gardens, in farmers' markets, in organic shops. And there's a lot of areas, or a lot of underserved people, that a lot of people left behind by this system at the same time. So I think what was also a driving factor behind initiating a food policy council in Berlin was this question: how can we create a local food system that works for everyone and not only for the people who can already now afford to buy in organic shops? I think always everyone has like different motives and reasons for getting involved in the food policy council. I think there's also a lot of environmental concerns and public health concerns for people to get engaged. But I think this context of justice and social justice and on the local level and global justice is always there, and was one of the reasons behind actually initiating a food policy council in Berlin. At least for me personally, that was one of the reasons why I co-initiated it. And I think a lot of people in Berlin share that concern as well. And I think what in Berlin as well is a big factor is that there, until very recently, there was from the state or from the city level, there was no nobody actually working on food. So there's no political level, no food department creating food policies. There is no food policy in Berlin so far, which for a city that has 3.5 million inhabitants just doesn't work. You have to make a plan how to actually feed people in the city and not just hope that it somehow happens. I mean, it works. It somehow happens. Everyone can buy cheap food in discounters, but that's not the kind of food system that we want. So we wanted to start actually thinking about how can we shape that food system so that it works for everyone and that it works for the environment and that it works for the region as well, because obviously Berlin is part of the region that it is, that it sits inside. So now we are in, we had a change of government in Berlin, which is good. We have a very sort of positive political situation, at least in Berlin at the moment, which is kind of different from some other areas here. So we are discussing with the city government, which in Berlin's case is also the state government, and are starting to develop a food strategy, or so at least that's the plan, and we are in discussions there. So the Food Policy Council is like the civil society actor engaging in the political discussion to bring forward a food strategy that is sustainable and just. That's our plan.
Great, thank you. Valentin, you commented, actually you wanted to be here just as the filmmaker, Valentin Thorn, but maybe do you want to add something from the perspective of the Food Policy Council of Cologne?
Well, actually, I'm here also here as the chair of the Cologne Food Policy Council, so I can briefly try to... I don't want to repeat what you said, because this almost also applies for our situation. It's just 2.5 years ago that we started this in Cologne, and it's kind of interesting. We were the first ones doing that. And just some months after that, you started in Berlin, but it was a concept totally unknown in Germany. Though you just told me in Toronto, you started like 26 years ago. In the US, there were even food policy councils like 30 years ago. So, I mean, this is something that has not been reached out to our country. I can question it. The certainly the urge was not that big because the hunger question is not that big, but we have a lot of other things. I mean, when I discovered the whole food topic, it was because of food waste. And I have to say, it was in 2007. It's really stunning because this amount of waste already existed for decades, and we just looked away. Everybody looked away. It's a good thing that now people really react on it and say, oh, this system must be sick. We have to change it. But it's also interesting to understand why we are so, yeah. Why it took us so much time? Why we denied what's going on here? Because it's obvious there is something very deeply enrooted in us that is, taking this food supply as something that is for granted. And I just have to recall. I mean, my main. Motivation to deal with food was actually, I have to say, it was my education. And it's not that far away. It's like one or two generations away that we had hunger in Germany, and now we just forgot about it. It's something that in this situation might be reasonable because we have enough money, we will buy it somewhere. But I think the lady from Britain said it quite clearly, and this is something we should always keep in mind. There is political situation where we can imagine that this very unstable food system is not working as smooth as it works now, and the techniques to bake bread or whatever will be important again as a survival technique. So this is not the main driver to create a food policy council, but this was my driver to act, because I think there is a value in itself to look on food, and the main driver was rather we had, like, in the last 20 years, half of our farms shut down. So we have this continuous change of agriculture and also of cultural landscape. I mean, that means monocultures are more and more dominant in the fields, and insects and birds are on a decline. So this is certainly one of the biggest drivers. And in our case, it was quite fortunate that we had already from the beginning a kind of mixture of farmers. We had not only the organic ones, we had also conventional farmers. And we really thought about to bridge this gap between those who are, I mean, it's like, it's a small sector, it's like 5% of the agriculture, and 95% are still conventional. And when you talk to them, you discover there's a big portion that really try to do things better, to go on a more sustainable path. They are not really, the market is actually punishing them. They have more costs. They need more effort to do that, more work, but they get the same price as those who just make it the cheapest way. So this is something we said. Okay, there must be, first of all, we need a coalition that is going beyond this usual. I mean, I'm a member of Slow Food. I love what they do, but beyond this small group of foodies, I would say, and really go to those people that are conservative or that are more mainstream, but are interested to have a sustainable, healthy food system on a local basis as well. So, and that's what we actually tried, and I think we reached out to many of those people, and also because we are Well, sometimes there are clashes. I remember when we were at our foundation meeting in town hall, the one organic farmer really held a speech that was really very. He was fighting for a cause, and almost our conventional farmers almost got out of the room. But we could keep them and could tell. Could continue the discussion in saying, well, there's certainly topics we will not agree, we'll probably for a long time not agree on glyphosate. Glyphosate is maybe something that we will have differences, but we find a lot of common issues like the use of surfaces, to create a system where local produce comes into the cities and fair prices for farmers, things like that, are really on a common aim. And this is how we created our coalition in Cologne. And our luck was that the city government decided 1.5 years ago to fund us one coordinator, and from that on, so we had one full-time staff that really from that time on could design projects and ask for money. So we have the first project now running, which is really huge. We had like 100 people already active in the different working groups. Then there is coming this project of Essbare Stadt. It's a little bit like Incredible Edible, but more on even smaller than a town level. It's like we don't want to make an expert paper. We want to make give people in the neighborhoods a structure to influence how their surroundings will be planted. So. Well, there's another 100 people active in these small neighborhood groups right now. So, and this is maybe one of the examples how we prefer to go on, not with expert papers, but rather with more participation from the citizens.
Thank you, Valentin. So, I can imagine that you already have like a lot of burning questions. I want to open up. Who's first? Questions in English or German?
Ich mache mal die Frage auf Deutsch. Die Community, also wie Community mit Essen zusammenhängt, das hatte er, glaube ich, aus Toronto sehr stark nochmal fokussiert. Das würde mich interessieren, wie das zusammenhängt, was es da für Beispiele gibt. Ist das verständlich?
Noch nicht ganz, wie die Community?
Der Herr aus Toronto, der hatte irgendwie Community and food that belongs somehow together. If you have some examples for that. To make it more visible, to get it.
Okay.
Did you understand?
I think so. We'll see. One thing none of us have mentioned yet, but could I just ask a question? How many people here were born after 1990? Three? Only three people here were born after 1990? Because I think... one thing that we need to note about food is that it is related to the millennial generation, in my opinion, and I'll try to give the answer to you about people in that regard. So certainly in North America, the food movement is mostly made up of youth and people who are now in, say, second-year university or that age group until graduate school. And I think there is a reason for that. One is they were born after 1990. That is, they have only really known the politics of neoliberalism in their life. So unlike my generation, which would have seen senior levels of government taking major initiatives in many areas, this generation has not seen federal governments taking initiative in any significant area. So I'm just reading an article about... antibiotics are being used so widely in industrial agriculture that we may lose antibiotics. Mm-hmm. And there's no government in the world that I'm aware of is moving on that issue. Just to give a simple one, no government that I'm aware of is moving on the issue of food waste. And global warming has exceeded all of its previous limits since we signed the Paris Pact. So this is a generation that has, I think, understood in a really gut sense that if there's going to be action, it's not going to be at that level. It's going to be at the personal level and at the community level in connection with local levels of government. So I think that's one aspect of it. The second is that the younger generation has grown up in the digital era. And I think food is one of the best antidotes to a life which is totally virtual. You smell it, you touch it, you taste it, you meet the people who produce it, and there is a yearning for those experiences. So in my youth, which was slightly later than Dr. Winnie over here.
you were my babysitter.
When young people wanted to be together, they met in cars. So the day I was 16, you know, I got my driver's license. My daughter's 24 and can't drive a car yet because young people today meet in restaurants. That is the habitat of the millennial. And so inevitably food gravitates to them. And I believe that the food movement is the creation of young people falling in love with the city at the same time as they fell in love with food. Okay, and the city is an exciting, liberating experience where people can be together in many different ways, and food coincides with exactly that. And so that's where I see the food and people connection happening at that level. But it does happen at every other level from birth until death. And so at birth, first of all, we have a party to welcome the newborn. I just became a grandfather 7 weeks ago, so I'm familiar with this. So you have a party with food to welcome a newborn, and then the newborn, with any luck, is being breastfed. And so they are learning bonding at the earliest age, both the mother and the child, right? And at the other end of the spectrum, death comes also with a memorial meeting where there's almost always food. And seniors also need very specialized food programs. So you can't just deliver the same carrots to somebody who has no teeth as you deliver to somebody who does have teeth. And so all of the senior-sensitive food programs cut up their carrots into little pieces. There are many, and also seniors tend to be women rather than men. Consequently, women are not used to cooking for themselves. They're used to cooking for their family and often don't cook adequately for themselves. And so we need to find new ways of providing food to keep people in community. So at whatever level of your age there is, we can enhance the food experience by mixing it with community.
Thank you. Hat das deine Frage beantwortet? Frage beantwortet? Super. Okay, who's next?
Thank you very much for this fantastic introduction into all the different experiences worldwide. And I would like to ask a question to Bruno from Brazil. I think your question also related to that a little bit, but Brazil, in a way, is really a very impressive example of, because you do have the right to food in your constitution, and you do have food programs, and you have Zero Fame. And could you tell us a little bit about all these achievements of the former government? What is happening now in Brazil related to the right to food and hunger? Thank you.
Well, indeed. I think the idea to talk about food and nutrition security councils in Brazil is also to bring the context into mind, because they have been the first ideas for councils that started in the early 90s after the military dictatorship were to bring into the agenda, the political agenda, the idea of hunger being the end of hunger in Brazil, the eradication of hunger. And for some time during the 90s, and then I completely relate to what Wayne said, because you had a very neoliberal government in Brazil, and this agenda, even though the hunger issues were in the public debate, but they weren't as finally treated by civil society organizations as it has started to be in the early 2000s, when you had a more progressive government open to public society, to public, to civil society organizations in the designing of policies, and in, when it was the last phase, or maybe the moment when the Food and Nutrition Security Councils were established. That was in the early 2000s. I think it was 2002, actually. It was also the beginning of the zero hunger strategy in Brazil. So it was the moment when some of the policies, as the national food, the national public food program, were shifted, because in Brazil you had this by law, the government had to provide food to all schools, to all public schools, since the 70s. And it was a demand from civil society organizations working with rural development and working with food issues. The food sovereignty, social movements that were discussing these issues demanded that the law shifted, and that it included the idea of that the government should buy 30% of food, at least 30% of food from family farmers that went to public schools. Also, the food acquisition program, which was a policy that was developed so that the government could buy food or seeds maybe from the farmers, and to provide local public institutions with these products. They were all these policies that were part of the zero hunger strategy and that took Brazil out of the map of hunger in 2014, they were all developed in, you could say, the atmosphere of the food councils or the Food and Nutrition Security Councils. Because in Brazil, you have a system for the councils. They happen in the national level, the state levels, and the municipality levels. And the idea is that these councils have their feedbacks into each other. So in a way that you can propose, design policies, but also monitor how they are being implemented. Well, so these were major achievements. And one other one that you mentioned, and it was also part of the demands that came from the council, was that in 2008 you had the idea of bringing the right to food to the constitution, to the Brazilian constitution. So in this sense, you can see that the experience of the food councils in Brazil have been a successful one in the sense of eradicating poverty and hunger and monitoring the policies and the way they were being implemented. But of course, it is a moment now that we don't know what the effect will be. We say that it is a moment where you have a low visibility in terms of the political future. The councils still exist. The councillors are already still in the councils, but we don't know what the effects will be for the policies, because in the general terms, what we have seen until now is huge cuts in the budget. So, at the same time, the councils are the space where civil society can express itself, where it can be heard, where it can gain recognition. So it is also an important an important issue to remain in these councils and to organize civil society organizations as well. Yeah.
I was wondering, while listening to the stories from the beginning of the food policy councils, especially in UK, Canada, and the USA, if you remember the obstacles you had to face in the beginning, like skepticism from local politicians or some obscure hygiene laws or whatever. So if there's like one moment you remember where you realized that implementing something new isn't always easy.
I can remember going to our mayor in Hartford, Connecticut in early 1990s and saying, hey, how about starting a food policy council? And he said, what the hell is that? Food just wasn't on the agenda. There was just too many other things going on and too many things that were serious. I mean, there was some crime was a serious problem. The revenues of the city were dropping. There were a number of economic and structural problems within the government that was not allowing it to function well, even with its accepted normal services and functions. So the idea of bringing food into the discussion just was completely, off the charts. It just didn't make any sense at all. But I think we were able to overcome that over time by being persistent, by demonstrating what impact had already taken place. Simply a farmer's market had already brought quite a bit of value to the community. And then the hunger issue became very, very apparent. I think that was probably our big breakthrough moment, which was a survey that had been done by a university that found extraordinarily high levels of hunger in the community. And I would say maybe as a lesson there is that when you're trying to convince somebody to move into a new direction, you do need to present some evidence. And it may not be hunger, it may be another issue. But if there's evidence that the problem is perhaps more severe than you thought, or perhaps there's more value there than you thought, and you can provide evidence to either way, you'll definitely get the attention of the political figures and pave the way toward the change you're looking for.
Christine, do you also maybe want to add something from
the
German
perspective? If I may, I think the question was mainly directed at everyone else on the panel, but I can answer. So I think one of the main challenges we have in Berlin, at least, is that, we're still in the starting phase, I would say, and we are still trying to form a network or a platform, and we're still very much volunteer-based, so we have very little funding. I think that is the main problem, because it's difficult to pull together a movement that actually achieves a significant change in the system when you have very little resources. And it also means that the ambition that we have to be a platform for all the food actors in Berlin and in the surrounding countryside is it's also quite difficult, because everyone has their jobs and everyone is in their day-to-day lives. When do we organize meetings? How do we get everyone to come to Berlin? Berlin being a big city as well, and then if you're like a farmer from somewhere in West Brandenburg and the surrounding area, and then the meeting may be in East Berlin, when are you going to go there if you actually have a field to tend to at the same time? So I think that's it's a financial resource challenge, but also just a time challenge. There's so many different actors that we want to bring together. And how do we? How does everyone make the time for this? And how do we convince everyone that they need to make the time for this? And that this this goal of actually working on the political side and being an umbrella for the for changing the political framework for food and to actually make urban food policies happen is actually something important next to the day-to-day challenges everyone is facing. And I think another big challenge that I see is, to me personally, I think is very important as well, is that, as I said, we want to create a food system that is just for everyone and also gives access to good food and to regional food to everyone. So we want to be a food policy council that works for everyone who lives in the city, but I don't think that at the moment we have managed to involve and engage everyone in the city. Because still, I mean, if you look at the people who are involved in the Food Policy Council in Berlin, we're still a very homogeneous group and sort of basically the same kind of people who go and buy in organic shops. And we do want to get out of that, and we're trying to find ways of how to really broaden the actors, how to involve more people and everyone who lives in the city. But it is difficult. It is a challenge. But we're working on it, and at least we're aware of it. I think it's very important to be aware of it and to try to find ways out of it rather than just not even be aware.
Thank you. And I think also Wayne wanted to add something.
Sure, thanks. Well, I think we have had more support than opposition. We're still in existence. And I was a one-person shop, and there's now eight people doing the well, they do eight times more than what I did. So, but I think that, to me, the book that really gave me insight into the problem that we faced was not about food, but about business. And you may know of this book here. It's called by Christensen, who's a professor at the Harvard School of Business, and it's called Disruptive Innovation. Disruptive innovation, that is an innovation that disrupts everything. And everything about food is disruptive. So we need to understand that when we face resistance, that there's a reason for it. What we're doing is disruptive. I'll give you an example. I'll give you four examples, actually, if you give me. One is urban agriculture might seem a very sensible thing, except city planners, as a profession internationally, they developed after food became a relatively secure matter for cities. That is, the profession of city planning developed after refrigerated trains and refrigerated ships. And the cities were no longer where people rioted when there wasn't enough food, because especially for people who are reasonably well-to-do, there was enough food. And so the urban planning profession has no consciousness of food in its DNA or anywhere else. And so the idea of urban agriculture is actually disgusting to them, okay? Because their commitment is to the highest use of land, and the highest use is retail and office towers, and the lowest use is agriculture. So we are inherently on a collision course. Nutrition is about a very narrow definition of food. I was talking last night with Valentin that we don't have the right word in English for food. We only have one word that covers every aspect of it. And in German, you have three different words. But that's not really what we're about. We're not about nutrition. We're not about food as a nutrient. We're about food as something that brings people together in an exciting new way, right? So we're disruptive to the vocabulary of German. And nutritionists and food people are very much at odds. And I believe the fundamental difference is this. Nutritionists worry about food. They worry you're going to eat too much fat and die. And food people love food and love the food experience. So that's a disruption. Food cuts across every sector, every department of the city, and every city department doesn't want to take on that additional responsibility. And then finally, if you take a country like Canada, which has fundamentally been founded by immigrants all within a fairly short period of time of a few hundred years, we developed a tradition called multiculturalism. And that is, you want to keep your Italian traditions, you want to keep your German traditions, that's fine. I'll keep my British traditions and we'll live in peace. But food challenges us not to be multicultural, but to be intercultural. And that is, I want to learn from people from Mexico's food traditions,
And if they want to learn from mine, I'm happy to teach. So food, as you know, every major city now is becoming a cosmopolitan, and global foods are part of the scene of every city. And that runs, there's no place in any official cultures for that kind of interaction. So we need to be patient with the fact that we are fundamentally a disruptive force, and not to see it as resistance, but just to see it as the difficulty people have in confronting change.
Thanks. Leon, do you also want to add something from, yes, from Mike?
Yeah, I would like to add a couple of things, but my role at Sustainable Food Cities is to direct support to our members, of which there's around 50 food policy councils, food partnerships, and I totally agree with everything that's been said so far. And we apply a life stages approach to our members, which is see where they're at, what they need, what support they need at the right time. So, yeah, I agree with everything that's been said now. I'll add three things. One is leadership. So very often we're aware of town cities where there's a lot of really good food activity going on, but it could be enhanced by those people involved in that activity coming together in some way in a food policy council. But it would take someone to step forward and convene that. And that can be really tricky because very often, usually in fact, that'll be an unpaid role and requires some commitment to start with. And one way that we've, in a very small way, we've tried to support that is by giving out grants. But generally, that's a very difficult thing, is leadership. It either happens or it doesn't. And the other one is collaboration can be really difficult. And it's already been discussed about, you know, in a city government, food sits everywhere and nowhere at the same time. But there's also problems in the other sectors, I think. And we've found that amongst the community sector, there can be, probably because of limited funding, a kind of territorialism. People, community sectors not wanting to collaborate as much as they should. And then also in the business sector, probably for financial reasons, often businesses don't want to share their knowledge amongst other businesses. So within sectors, there can be a lack of collaboration. And then between sectors, there can also be a lack of collaboration. So one challenge and one thing to overcome, I think, is making sure that everybody who comes to the table is willing to share and have similar aims. And the third challenge is we find quite a lot, and it can be a real difficult leap, is that move from discussion, policy, think tank type activity to action. Like, what are we going to do? What are we here for? So I think that can be a real challenge. And we found that, and I was reading it earlier, maybe something that you wrote, actually, I can't remember, but something around early wins, some really simple, clear actions that can make a difference locally, and then more ambitious stuff later as well. So that to keep morale high is do something. Make sure that your group, your food policy council, does something quite early on, and you can celebrate that. So those are the three things that I would add.
Actually, we tried to do some of these quick wins, but speaking about 2.5 years, we still haven't got there. So it's just starting. So yeah, it takes time. It's awfully a lot of time, and the advantage is that we are a process coming out from the citizenship. So I told you that we got support from the city government, but the city government doesn't run our food policy council. If not, it would take us another 10 or 20 years to be there where we are. And people in the city government, they know this. They know that they are quite slow in certain things. So that's why they also appreciate what we're doing. And we were considering the fact to have quick wins. Like there's one program we're doing with the kindergartens, with the canteens at the kindergartens. That might be next year. That might be some kind of a really huge program when it's running. That might be such a quick win. But in the same time, we start something which takes more time. It is more abstract to have a vision, a strategy for our food system. on a broad base. It's an abstract discussion that will probably never enter into the public mind so much than this Edible City or these other programs that we're doing, but is, of course, even more important on the long run. But we're doing it. We didn't do it to start. We did it as well. After 1.5 years of working, we decided, okay, maybe this is the moment to start also this kind of strategy work. And we were astonished that at the city government we had people really, really very keen to do that. We had a change in the city government. The fortunate thing was we could use the election campaign for our purpose, because when there was this discussions, we were really looking that both the biggest party candidates, that both of them were kind of involved, and we asked them, "Are you supporting us?" And both of them tried to say, "Yes, this is our idea, our goal." So we said, "Okay, great. If this is a competition, we appreciate that." So in the end, we had this political support we needed, but the base of all of this, and this is maybe one of the biggest challenges you were addressing, challenges. The base was still how to create, how to get in. I mean, I told you about the farmers. They were present because we had this association already, but how to keep them constantly coming is much more difficult, because they have longer ways. They were coming in the first meetings. I remember they had tears in their eyes about the fact that people in the city really are interested in their fates. "You're coming 30 years too late," they told to us. But of course we know that after some time, I mean, to come like 50 or 100 kilometers into the city is quite a challenge. They're not among those who really constantly come and work. So what we decided, and this is the challenge you have to find out, where the farmers meet somewhere outside the town in the farms. They have their own group. Another group that is also very difficult to gather is the chefs of restaurants. You can only meet during the day, sometime on Mondays maybe. So you have every group has some other challenges to find, but all of them are important for the food system. So this took us some time to find it. And finally, the most important is that you don't only work; you also have to, you have to eat to find something that brings it together. Like yesterday, we did, and he enjoyed very much there's a saying, Köln lässt keinen allein, Cologne doesn't leave anyone alone. So we were at a table in a restaurant where people that we didn't know, they were just coming and talking to us. And well, this is the thing that I appreciate with food, and you do, as I could see, that it brings people together. And we should never forget that, yes, we want to do some political work, but we also need some kind of, the groups need some fun to really work.
Bruno, you still want to add some? You already talked about challenges quite a lot in Brazil, but still, like, from your experience, or you don't have to.
Well, if you could imagine that during so much time when the civil society organizations didn't have the space to express their demands to the council, to the government, they would have been interested in participating in the council. So that was what happened. You know, it was a space where people wanted to be there, the organizations that were, the social movements wanted to be in the councils. So in this sense, we didn't face those challenges. Yeah, but indeed, I think I can find some similarities, because there are times when we seem to be talking among ourselves, because it's the same sectors of society that are worried with that issue that keep on participating in that. So I think one interesting thing that I should mention is how the National Coalition for Agroecology
has started since 2015. Their encounters are based on the power to communicate to other sectors of society. The motto right now is, why should society support agroecology? And agroecology in Brazil is not, well, is a lot of things. It is practices, it is social movements, it is policies, it is science, research, that, you know, it is, it gathers lots of social movements discussing food sovereignty, food security, rural development in a broad sense. And I think this is, the power to communicate is also an aspect that we must take into account. So how do we go out of our own bubbles and talk and convince others, yeah, something in this sense?
Ja, in dem Film 10 Milliarden wird ja die konventionelle Landwirtschaft und ökologische Landwirtschaft auch so immer wieder so einander gegenübergestellt. Und ich merke so, also ich bin lange auf diesem Organic-Bio-Weg, Jahrzehnte eigentlich, weil mir das so, weil ich finde, das ist natürlich. Und mich interessiert, wie das in den einzelnen Gruppierung ist, wie die konventionellen und Biobauern miteinander klarkommen oder wie weit das ein wichtiges Thema ist, auch in den anderen Ländern.
Just because I...
Yeah, I wanted to give a translation.
Sorry.
Yeah.
I was forgetting about
okay.
that.
So the question was... As the film also contrasts conventional agriculture and organic agriculture, and what's your name?
Susanne.
Susanne was just mentioning that she has been supporting organic agriculture for a long time because it seems like more natural to her, and she would be interested in, like, in your countries, how organic agriculture and industrial conventional agriculture actually, like, live side by side, and what kind of conflicts there are, maybe. So Valentin, you wanted to ask.
I just want to say I think this is unfortunate, this divide between, because there is industrial organic as well, or a kind of a conventional farming that is very near to organic. So we to have, like, black and white is not the way I would look on it. We have therefore established a kind of matrix to look on an individual farm, which one is more sustainable. We were astonished. It didn't exist on from some government agencies or whatever. And I was even more astonished to hear that in Toronto you do just the same thing, because really we need to look beyond this marketing tool. It's a good thing. I really like the organic movement, but in some parts when they came to supermarkets, they got away from their roots. There's lots of organic stuff being imported right now. So, but the main argument in the film, and then I hand over to others, is that the situation here, organic, they're conventional, is something from the rich countries. We have to, if we look on how to feed the world, we have to see that in other countries, like in developing countries, there is another difference that is much bigger and more relevant. This is the contradiction between big farms and smallholders. And there's a difference. Of course, the smallholders in the developing countries, they produce near to organic because they lack of capital and they don't have so much pesticides and fertilizers. But they're not organic. If they get hold of some money, they still use it. The thing is that, and this is really important, that they have the capacity to harvest more from a hectare of land than any big farm, always, in every country around the world. Why is it like that? They have enough workforce. And that's not the case with our organic farmers. they harvest less than the conventional ones because they live in a high wage country, and they need to mechanize. They cannot put in so much workforce. It's too expensive here. So if we consider this or that, we always have to keep in mind the situation, the economic situation where the agriculture is there. I mean, probably you're the only one that really can see this difference from your perspective.
Yeah, well, in Brazil, it is a country with huge contradictions in that sense. Yeah, you are the country with the exporting a lot of commodities, producing genetically modified soya, maize, and things like that. On the one hand, you have the Amazon and the deforestation processes. You have so a powerful agribusiness going on in Brazil. At the same time, where Brazil is also the largest consumer of pesticides in the world, and you also have to take into account that 85% of all food that goes to Brazilian plates do not come from agribusiness, come from family farmers, and so family farming also is a heterogeneous universal thing in Brazil. You have different kinds of family farmers in the whole country because, you know, you have different regions and the contexts are what give the identities to family farmers in Brazil. Well, and we have this idea of there is a market for organics growing in Brazil, you know, but you also have the danger of having monocultures of organic production in some areas. So when we talk about agroecology, as I was mentioning, we talk about a different way to produce and to work with agriculture that is closer to nature and that is very reliable, that is that relies a lot on the local contexts. Because, for example, if you talk about sustainable agriculture in the semi-arid areas, you are talking about an agriculture that's very different from the agriculture in the southern areas of Brazil. And you also have this idea that who has the knowledge today to work in these areas, or the knowledge that comes from the farmers should be taken into account a lot when you had many processes that scientific research in Brazil in agronomy for long have been based on the Green Revolution, and they never took into account the idea for how farmers were in their environment. So you had the experiences of bringing dairy implementing dairy production in the northeastern areas, which just couldn't exist because it was not a local reality. But the idea was to bring cows to that area where you had processes of desertification, and farmers knew that it wouldn't work, but they were never listened. So the idea is how to take advantage of the knowledge of these farmers that have been dealing, that have been coping with their environment for so long, and trying to produce sustainable agriculture in their areas. I don't know if I answered the idea, but yes, is dealing with these contradictions and seeing other ways, not only in the clear division into agribusiness and organic in Brazil, but also the transition processes that are in between. Yeah.
it's an incredibly complicated and difficult subject, but I mean, I see constant conflict between organic growers who are in conflict with other organic growers. I see organic growers in conflict with conventional growers. I see that the issue is often a matter of consumer perception. Consumers may not want to buy. They may not. They believe what they want to believe, whether the facts are true or not, and this has often led to poor choices. For one example, is that integrated pest management as a good way to raise crops in parts of the U.S. which have say high humidity and you can't really grow good organic orchard crops. Is a good accepted practice, good farming practice that reduces the impact on the environment. Yet, consumers don't understand integrated pest management and think that it's, and don't think it's organic enough. I think, on the other hand, we've seen a shift in how conventional growers think about organic food and organic production, in that they are starting to accept the science behind it. They also see that there is economic value. In the U.S., I think last time I checked, it was something like $40 billion a year in organic sales, and it just keeps going up significantly every year. I think about it is, how do I get people around the table to talk about these things? And the Food Policy Council is a place where I'd like them to get around the table and have a good, robust conversation about it. And it's difficult. I find it difficult to get farmers of any ilk together. I think maybe as you were saying earlier, how do you get them there? So, cultivating a few farmers to be a part of a Food Policy Council or to be a part of the conversation who are, let's say, open-minded enough to be able to see all the different values and see the opportunities for agriculture if we can begin to find some common ground and accept different practices and begin to shift our practices perhaps in a more sustainable direction. I think these are the ways that I'm trying to think about it now, that we, our Food Policy Council can be a place for this to happen. And one other example is is how can we support local agriculture? To me, in a way, that's perhaps more important than trying to support organic agriculture. I can make more progress if I'm thinking about how do I support local agriculture and local farmers, because I know our shoppers at a farmer's market are shopping there because they want to support a local farmer, not so much because they're going to buy organic food or conventional food, but they know they're going to be helping their own and helping their own community by buying from a local farmer. So that's kind of how I would frame the discussion.
Okay, just I think what you're just saying about local is quite interesting, because I think I would also not put so much on a label that says organic or bio, as it is in German, but more on scale, but more on the scale in the sense of how big or how small is the farm, or can you actually call it a farm, or is it actually an agro-industrial enterprise that has huge tracts of land? And what we want to support is, of course, farms, local farms. But if you look at Brandenburg, local isn't necessarily good, because we've got a lot of mass meat production factories and a lot of large-scale maize production for animal feed and biofuel. So I wouldn't necessarily say we want to support all local farming business, because that doesn't actually help or change our food system very much. But we want to have a system where small-scale local farmers that produce sustainably, whether they have an organic label or not, have a chance to survive in the system, basically, and to actually have a chance to get land and to start their business and bring their food to Berlin, which at the moment is not very much the case. So that's the plan.
Just to add something about the local idea, I think also in Brazil, where you have a huge country, and for us, in many situations, you can say the local is not. We have an idea that the local is not only geographical, but also that is socially constructed. You have ties of affinities between markets that are socially constructed markets. And for many times we have this idea that the local cannot be based on geography only, but also on these social ties and the construction, the social construction of markets. I think it's something to be taken into account as well. Yeah,
I think it's a very important question, and it gives an example of what it means when we say that food is a disruptive innovation, because all businesses depend on differentiation. You know, that Mercedes is better than Volkswagen, and Volkswagen is better than Mercedes, or whatever it is. And so within the food movement, there are businesses that depend on differentiation, that organic is better than non-organic, or local is better than non-local. So that's the business imperative, is differentiation. The political imperative is political differentiation. The Green Party, only the Green Party could save the world, and the Social Democrats will never do the right thing by the environment. And the Social Democrats are the only party, and the Greens will always sell out because they don't have an anti-capitalist viewpoint. So, and in ethics of a Western society in particular, there is good and there is evil. So everything is about differentiation, and the food movement is not. We are about, in my opinion, building a big tent. And that's to keep a food policy council together. In my experience, we must have an approach of the big tent. So organic is not perfect, but I'm totally in support of the effort. Local, I'm totally supportive, but you brought up some really valid reasons. And in our city of Toronto, half of the population was born outside of Canada. So we can't have a totally local view, and it would exclude half of the population from having their favorite foods. So we cannot afford to be dogmatic, and we have to build a big tent. Otherwise, we will falter.
So, ich habe noch genau zwei Meldungen. Da war eine und die als nächstes. Ich glaube, erst hinten. Mhm.
Hallo. Ja, genau. Nochmal eine Frage. In den letzten 20 Jahren, in dem Ihre Policies da bestehen, hatten Sie die Möglichkeit, Bürger zu gewinnen, Mitgliedsbeiträge zu zahlen, damit man unabhängig wird von finanzieller Förderung durch die Städte? Und sind Sie konfrontiert worden mit Unterwanderung von Monsanto, Bayer oder großen Handelsunternehmen, die versuchen, ihre Politik zu beeinflussen? Und wie sind sie damit umgegangen?
Okay, so I'm going to try to translate these two questions, actually. The first was whether you could actually, like in your different experiences of food policy councils, whether you could gain members that actually pay fees in order that so that you can get like independent in your work, independent from public money. And with what arguments? So, like, what were the arguments behind it? And the second question was whether, like, big companies, you mentioned Bayer or other big, like, agribusiness players, actually try to influence your kind of politics through sponsoring, or was that what you had in mind? Uh-huh. So, like, if just people entered and with hidden agenda and try to influence, and how you actually dealt with if this was the case in any of your experiences.
Yeah, Monsanto has not tried to buy a seat at the table, as far as I know, of any food policy council. And I doubt if they would get very far if they even thought about the idea. I think there have been a few food policy councils that have assessed dues and on a sliding scale, I mean, on a small amount. But the total contribution of those dues to the cost of operating a council is not very significant. So it hasn't been a very productive way to try to fund the work of a food policy council. It ironically, and there's been sponsorships of large food corporations of non-food policy council efforts. Some of our anti-hunger work in the United States, at our national level in particular, organizations like the Food Research Action Center and Feeding America, these are our two biggest food organizations. One works on food banks, the other works on federal food programs. They have received a significant sponsorships from large food corporations. And I think to a justifiable amount of criticism and their work and their advocacy has been skewed in the direction of those food corporations. I could give you examples later on if you want. But I think I would make an argument. I don't know if Herr Robert would agree or not, but the idea that food policy councils ought to be publicly funded, that there ought to be serious public support for that kind of work. At the same time, this is always an argument, is how independent does the Food Policy Council need to be from whether it's industry or government or anything else? That's always an argument. And I think there's many ways and many examples of how they can preserve their independence. However, being a part of the public process, I think, is really critical to the success of food policy councils. And if that means, or in part, if that means that the food policy council receives funding from government, then I think that's fine. I don't see any problem with that. I have not seen a place where the work of the food policy council has been compromised by their association with government.
If anyone wants to talk about the organic question, I work for the biggest certifier of organic food in Britain, so I have to be careful what I say, but maybe not later on. But it is a very interesting question, but I won't talk about that now. Nationally, we don't take any sponsorship for sustainable food cities, but we're lucky enough to have funding from a charitable trust that likes what we do and lets us get on with it. Locally, our groups, they all want to be independent. They all want to be critical friends of every sector, including the community sector and the business sector. That's pretty difficult if you're working on volunteer time. So a lot of the funding does come from local government. So there is a bias there, but it's usually a bias towards public health. So it's not too bad, but it can skew what the work that the local group does in some ways towards health activity. It can be really difficult. Some of our groups do take food sponsorship from local food companies. I'm not sure what I think about that. Depends what the company's like. But we're not aware of any national or multinational companies supporting the local groups. I am aware that some of them would like to, and it's very often through the food poverty. Nestle are involved quite heavily with food poverty in Britain. It's a challenge for the local groups because they're often unfunded. Somebody comes along with some money and says, you don't have to mention Nestle. You do what you want. It's not always like that. So you've got to be very, very careful there. So, yeah.
Okay, yeah. So that was the next question.
Gab es irgendwo schon einmal eine externe Begleitforschung
oder im Rahmen von Action Research Erfahrung, welche realen Outputs Ernährungsräte machen? Oder die ketzerische Frage, lohnt sich der Aufwand?
Okay, like the short version of the question is if the efforts of if the outcome is worth like all the effort, all the work that's behind the food policy councils, or if there have been any studies that actually prove like what are the outcomes and what are the costs.
I'll do a quick answer to that one. We're trying to build an evidence base in Britain. For our programme and for local food programmes. It's very difficult. We've got evidence that certain food activity has good outcomes. We've got evidence that partnership working can work in other areas. We're now currently engaging a university to see if those two things work together. You know, is it better to have a partnership, a food policy council? Will the outcomes be better if that's there, or if it's not in place? So we're doing that for, which is phase two of our programme, so doing that up to 2019. So we'll see, but we're hopeful. But it is what the question was about, having an evidence base, I think. And I think it's really important to have that, because increasingly local government, national government are asking for it. They want to know what is the evidence that the outcomes are good. And one of the hardest things, I think, to measure is the function of a food policy council, where it is networking or coordinating activity, so bringing people together, and then good things happen from that. How do you measure that? It's very difficult, because you don't always know what the outcomes are, and if the outcomes are good, they may not be acknowledged that they were started at a food policy council. They may say, well, we were going to do this anyway. So it is a tricky thing to measure, I think. Yeah.
I've been at this my whole life, so it better be worth it. Otherwise, I might kill myself. You know, so you know, don't provoke an existential crisis for me right now. So I think the problem. The larger problem here really is, how do you evaluate policy work over a long period of time? You can start a farmer's market or a community garden or some other food project and have some results in a year. But if I'm going to be a food policy council and I'm trying to really shift the whole playing field about food in my community, that is going to take a long time. And it is very difficult to convince those who are going to give money for that kind of work that to be in it for the long haul, to you know, make sure there's funding available for 5 years or whatever, at the minimum, to keep this work going. But there is more evaluation work being done about food policy councils. I'm associated with Johns Hopkins University, and we have a, you know, increasingly more evaluation information is becoming available. More studies and more reports are becoming available. We have those online. We're doing a lot of tracking of the actual achievements or results of independent or of each food policy council. And the list of achievements is huge. It's a very, very long list. You'd have to look at each single achievement and then try to evaluate that against, well, what else? What if they did something else? So it's a very difficult area to evaluate, but I do think that there is a growing body of evidence that, you know, this kind of work is making a substantial difference. And our ability to evaluate is also increasing as well.
I think in Germany the movement is still quite young, so it's a bit difficult to already evaluate, even though I think there are some things that are worth doing, even if you find out in the end that nothing changed, but you still have to do them. But I wanted to bounce this question back, because now you're unprepared, but I know there are at least two people in the audience who are actually doing research on food policy councils and food movements, and I'm talking about Annelie and maybe Marit, and you're unprepared. But maybe you have something to say on this. Is this worth it? Sorry.
Question, and I can't answer it either, and I haven't found that much evidence either so far, but I'm still working on it. But Wayne, I would bounce the question back to you again. And you wrote the Toronto Food Policy Charter and the Action Plan, and you had quite amazing goals in that charter 20 years ago or so. Do you think you have achieved any of those?
Well, since he left, they started to.
Yeah, they've achieved a lot since I left, but I don't want to have an existential crisis at the same time as Mark. But I am the only person who's been in this game longer than he is probably here. But actually, before I came here, I was in Milan, where they have a beautiful cathedral, and which was built between 1300 and about 1999, right? It took a long time to finish, and I'm sure the beautiful cathedral in Cologne took a long time, and I think we have to have that approach to what we're doing. It's a long time. I'm not going to see it, and you're not going to see it either. And I think I spent probably 40 years in the far left, which had an apocalyptic understanding of a revolution that was going to happen in our time and would be totally transformative, which has proven to be a total illusion. And so as coming out of the ashes of that, when I got active in food, I made a commitment that it had to be a solutionary movement, a positive movement, and it had to be built on joy at every stage. So I have no regrets if I don't see the end of it. And I think you have to organize food policy councils and other movements so there is always pleasure in them at the same time as struggle.
Christine actually mentioned two experts. So Anneli, behind there, do you still want to add on this?
Sorry, you thought you got away, but
yeah. So just to add, so as you mentioned, so the movement in Germany is very young. So of course, current research is focusing on the emergence of the movement of the food policy councils. But so my impression is that things you mentioned, like bringing people together, networking, like open up the agenda, is kind of core outputs or evidence. And of course, it's difficult to measure that. But hopefully, we'll have the opportunity to have more research on food policy councils in the future, and also like focus more on some evidences, however tricky this might be.
And if I may add one thing, I mean, at least there's evidence what works and what doesn't, and what are maybe pitfalls. And I think we talked about the obstacles. So I think there's a lot of ideas that people can learn from each other. And there are some ideas I could share, but we can do this over the next days, I think, as well.
Thank you. You still wanted to add?
I'm going to bounce this, come at this from one other direction, which is... just because I happen to just write a book about it. And it's the idea that we've been working on food issues for quite a long time. And I'm speaking, of course, from a U.S. perspective, but we've seen enormous increase in the number of food banks, enormous increase in the numbers of farmers markets, enormous increases in organic food. I can go on and on, just over 20 years, incredible increases in all these different sectors of the food system. Yet when we look at the numbers of food insecurity, the rates of obesity and diabetes, and the growth and the relative strength of the industrial food system, we haven't seen much progress. And I have to ask the question, why, with the incredible growth and diversity of this food movement, are we still kind of stuck with the same numbers that we've had for a long time, and maybe in some cases worse? My thesis is that we're not working together. The reason we haven't made progress, the kind of progress I'd like to make, is because we, all the different sectors of the food movement, haven't worked well together. We haven't collaborated. And I think the Food Policy Council, as I have seen it, provides that one place in every community where we can collaborate. And so that's the reason that I think there's a promising direction.
Okay, there was one more question over here.
I think it's very impressive that in Brazil there are food policy councils on different institutional levels, policy levels. And I was wondering, what about the federal, state levels and the national level in Canada, US, and the UK. So how is there any developments on establishing food policy councils there? And if so, is there any channels between the different levels in terms of communication or resource flow, something like that?
Okay, so you mean on a, do you say federal?
Yeah, like if it fits to your country, of course. I mean, I think maybe it's maybe
the local level.
Okay, yeah, like sorry. Okay. Well, at the national level, there is no food policy at all. There will have to be soon because of, and you've all politely not mentioned it, Brexit, which is nice. Yeah, I didn't know which channel to go in when I came through the airport. I was a bit worried. I didn't think it stopped like that. I thought, oh, right, which, maybe later. So there's going to have to be something, and because it is, and it's deliberate at a national level, because there's been neoliberal policies towards food and agriculture for a long time. And we were the first country in the world to industrialise our food culture, and it'll take us probably longer to do anything about it. But something's going to happen at a national level, because when the common agricultural policy payments are removed from our farmers, something else is going to have to happen, or we will have a collapse of farming in Britain. What will probably happen, unfortunately, is more industrial farming, but it's also an opportunity to do something a bit different, and weird things happen. Yesterday, Michael Gove, a British politician, supported the banning of neonicotinoids in farming. He's a very unpopular politician, so I'm not quite sure if we want him as an ally. But it's strange things can happen. So at that level, not much. But what is happening, which is quite interesting, is at a regional level, there is some work going on. And to support that, we, Sustainable Food Cities, have developed a regional membership. And so this is where regions, and when we talk about regions, we're talking about large areas, but also city regions. So Greater Manchester, Greater London, they are interested in food, and there is a food board in London. We're hoping there's going to be one in Manchester. So there's some changes happening there, but the national level, it's pretty chaotic. At the regional level, things are starting to happen. At the local level, there's still lots of activity. Yeah.
Just to add about the Brazilian experience, it started actually in the national level. So the idea came from the national level, but I think it wouldn't work if there weren't the councils in the state levels and the municipality levels, because the idea is to monitor and to design policies that are informed by local. So it's the idea here in the councils are not the top-down policies, but the policies that learn from the local realities. And even though it started then in the national level, if it were not informed by the local levels, I think it wouldn't work.
I hear Donald Trump is very concerned about the lack of a national food policy for the United States. We have not had any success at all in trying to establish a national food policy or food policy council. The strategy in the U.S. at the national level is for sort of individual programs and sectors to look for their own respective programs, to establish a program at the national level that will then be funded. But this leads to additional fragmentation. So we'll have a $5 million a year program here, a $20 million a year program over here. Basically, everybody gets their own program, but it does not create any kind of cross-sectoral unity in the process. It doesn't lead to anything that looks like a national food policy or national food policy council.
I think there's three. There's many elements to a food policy council, but there's three are fundamental. I think one is that it is an instrument of what is called in English deliberative democracy, and that is we don't just in this day and age elect a government, and then the government can do whatever it wants. It needs to consult with citizens, and especially informed citizens, while making all its decisions. So I think that principle is relevant at the municipal level, at national and subnational levels. So that's the first principle. So something deliberative should happen at all levels. And secondly, I think the old idea that government delivers a program and government's the only deliverer of it as a monopoly service is now obsolete. They should be always working in partnership with many groups in the community and even in the business sectors and universities and the like. And that should happen at the local level, the national level, and the subnational level. But the third thing about food policy councils is they happen at cities where people can, as far away as the local farmers might be, or as far, you know, as hardworking as the chefs are, they're all within, you know, 25 or 30 kilometers of one another. We all have a common experience. We all have a common commitment to certain sense of place and what the identity of our city is. And we all confront urban problems and urban opportunities. And so for that reason, I believe food policy councils are uniquely suited to cities, but two of the three principles of food policy councils should spread to other levels of government as well.
Thank you. So I think we still have time for one or maximum two more questions, because afterwards I think we all still have a long weekend, our international guests as well, and maybe they still want to rest like a little bit. So one or two more questions. Nothing.
I'll try it. And I think we have in Germany one problem. It's the opinion about value of food. In Germany, we have the lowest prices of in food in the world, I think. And the public opinion is food must be cheap. And I want to have a lot of food on my plate for less money. How can Ernährungsräte public... the English word, food councils, sorry. How can food councils help to increase the opinion about value of food? Is there a problem in your countries paying money for food also?
We have exactly the same debate. You know, people who are, shopping at, buying, you use the term organic shops and other... or farmers' markets. I mean, we use the term food elitist, you know, sort of to separate a group of people who have no problem paying any price for food that fits kind of their lifestyle and their preferences and various values. But most of the population is still looking for the cheapest food, hence the growth of places like Walmart and other big chains. I think the role of food policy councils has been so far has been trying to level the playing field to make more programs and services and policies available that will enable lower income people to be able to buy that so-called elitist food. You know, we have many programs now. In fact, I went to my own farmer's market a couple of months ago, and I counted no less than five different programs designed to provide incentives to mostly lower-income families to shop at that farmer's market. And I thought that was, I found that a little perplexing to see that many programs and have it be somewhat fragmented like that. And I'm not convinced that's the long-term solution, but at least that's been, so far that's been the strategy. I'll just leave it at that for now.
I might add something that really is some perspective of the last, 10 years. We have had the number of people that really want to know where their food comes from doubling. So it's really a huge trend, a mega trend, and it's continuing. This is really the official marketing figures from Germany, but I think they're not just exclusively German. They think that in about 5 years we will reach 30% of the consumers. They're not all buying organic or all buying regional, but you can convince them. They are interested in this kind of So you can work with that. It's a big minority. Of course, that also means that we still have 70 or 75% that pay according to prices. That's true. But in my eyes, this is maybe a situation like when we had, when I was getting politicized in the 80s, we were fighting against nuclear power. And at that time, they told us, "Are you're lunatics? An industrial society needs cheap energy." And these lunatics at that time, in my town, we were re-establishing an old water mill to produce energy, and others were working on solar or wind power, or whatever. And it took us like 30 years. In Germany to have a government policy changing, and it also took us a major accident in Japan to convince this government. But anyway, they did that also because the small isles of solutions, the small islands of solutions that were already grown up, were bigger and bigger and proved that this could work. And I think we're in the food system, we're probably in the same stage than in the energy system in the 80s. We have to build up islands of solutions that prove to be that other concepts can work. And there will be a time, I don't know if it also needs a major accident, something like that, to convince policymakers, but somewhere in the future we need these kind of evidence that we start right now.
Just before I answer that, there's one thing I want to say positively around the national food movement, the question that was asked earlier, because we have a national conference every year, and our last one was in Edinburgh in Scotland, and we had about 120 people arrived, and it was just fantastic, and it suddenly realised that this was a food movement, and if we could agree on one or two simple asks, simple questions to national government, we could be quite a forceful lobby. And I don't know why it took us so long to realise that, but we did. So when you ask what's happening nationally, well, this is what's happening nationally, you guys here. And this is like your first conference, I guess. So food and price is a big issue in Britain. Food can be unbelievably cheap. You can get a bag, you can get 20 frozen beef burgers for around €3 from these specialist frozen stores. Or around the corner, you go out for a meal, costs you €100. Very expensive restaurants. It's a huge problem. What a lot of our food partnerships, food policy councils are doing, and this is also to support themselves and get some income stream, is to connect up with or start some box schemes. And the box schemes have been really successful in Britain. So using local produce into a box scheme and then being delivered or picked up. And it's often meaning good food at a reasonable price because it's shortening the food chain, the food supply chain. So that's one thing that we've noticed that's been happening nationally.
Christina?
I think in Germany, or everywhere, I think food is quite cheap here, but I think it's also dangerous to focus on consumer responsibility and how consumers value food and how to raise how to educate consumers to value food more, because it puts a lot of responsibility on the consumers, while at the same time there's a huge advertising and marketing industry that teaches us all that we need new smartphones every year or week or month or whatever, and need all kinds of technological gadgets and clothes and whatever, all kinds of consumer products that we need all the time to be part of society. While I really don't see advertising for good food very often. And that's the kind of stuff that consume. You have to be very strong in your as a citizen to actually fight against that and to not then assume that, okay, these are the things I need to be part of society, so the only thing I can save on is food. And then there's also the issue of fixed costs that you can't get away from, so rents are rising all the time. You have to pay your rent, otherwise you don't have a house. Or a roof over your head, you have all the kind of taxes that you have to pay, you have the heat and costs for mobility and all the kind of costs that you have to pay, otherwise you can't participate in society. So the cost that you can actually adapt personally on a personal level is how much you spend on food. That's one of the costs that you can play with, basically. And I think it's unfair to consumers a lot of time to actually say, like, well, then don't buy a new smartphone, but spend more on food and value food more. It's fair enough, but everyone around you has new smartphones, and it's or everyone pays the mobility fee to get to work, and you can't just say, like, oh, okay, I'm not going to pay that. I'm going to walk 2 hours to work. So I think that makes it difficult to only focus on the value. Of course, valuing food is important, but it's I think it's dangerous to only focus on that.
I think a good start would be to raise awareness among the consumers to not throw away, would be a start. And then next step is to change your life and buy better food and pay for more food and make this choice. I mean, because otherwise we don't come any further. If we always say we have costs there and there and there and we can't make choices in contributing to resolve the problem we're discussing, but we can do, we have an impact, and that's what this film shows also, or the other film you made, Taste the Waste, is start not throwing food away, because this is what consumers are buying today in the situation you describe, in the very narrow financial narrow situation, but they still throw food away, one-third. And beginning there, we can resolve a lot of problems that we're discussing. And the answer would be, I don't think that a food council can raise awareness among consumers, but awareness campaigns among consumers. And this is actually to be funded, and therefore we need food councils and politicians that funding these things, which we don't have in Germany, for example.
Yeah, exactly. Another comment to that. I actually see the problem. Yeah, funding is a good keyword, but the agricultural system in Europe, and I'm sure also in other countries, is highly subsidized, and the subsidies currently go as much into industrialized agriculture as it go or as they go into more socially and ecologically just agriculture or farming. And if we kind of channel these subsidies into the kind of agriculture which is really supporting life and livelihoods, then also the food we kind of are preferring or like talking about here is also cheaper. And I think this is a political question, and we all like with all this food policy council discussions, for me it is really important that we don't forget that it's a huge political issue, and we have to do action on the local level. We have to rebuild the structures, but we shouldn't forget to kind of build this movement, what we are maybe currently doing here during this weekend, and with these structures to kind of go into politics and also, claim or like raise our voice. And
so I think I have to make two contradictory statements about this issue. And one is, I think it's hard to find any serious food problem that is not related to the fact that food is too cheap. You know, that's why people are eating food. They're eating their cheap food and then getting multi-$1,000 operations on diabetes and the like. So for every case of child onset diabetes in Canada is a lifetime cost of $1.5 million to the medical system. So there's no way that that is cheap food. It's called cheap food, but it's just low cost food at the point of purchase. And the second point, which is equally true, is it would be political suicide for us to campaign against cheap food. Because people do want to have these other things that you're talking about, and they're not going to say, well, I don't mind living in a grungy apartment because I'm eating good food. So the answer, I think, is the reason why the food is cheap, we need to understand it, is because they externalize the true costs of the food in the production. That's why we have global warming. That's why we have toxic rivers and everything else. Even if you say that to the consumer, however, they say, well, we've already got that. At least I can get cheap food. So I only see two ways that we can campaign and that, in my opinion, have generally met with some success. And one is people do support the idea of government purchasing of local and sustainable food even though it comes at an increased margin. And when you're buying at those volumes, the price does not have to be that significantly higher to be able to purchase from local and sustainable farmers. So it might only be 50 cents for a meal, whereas for us at individual items sold individually, they do amount to a lot. But in bulk purchasing, they aren't. And the second thing I think is we should subsidize farmers who provide environmental goods and services. Okay, so there's many cities in the United States are now familiar with the cost of water runoff in the billions of dollars, and I'm sure many European cities have over the last 20 years faced it. That's part of global warming, and food is a major contributor to global warming. So why do we not pay farmers to produce soil and to have other amenities on their land that absorb more water and keep it out of the city, or to clean air, or to soak carbon in the soil with perennial plants? So all of these things are going to mitigate the costs of global warming, and farmers are the people who are producing carbon. That's their job, and put it in the ground. So I think what we have to do is, the problem with organic food is that it's expensive because the farmer and the consumer have to absorb the entire cost of the environmental cost. And we should say that if big business is able to externalize its cost of production, then we have to find a way that we can, that the organic farmer and consumer can externalize their cost, and government should pay that environmental fee. And I believe that in areas where it's been tried, people have understood it. There's farmers in Canada who are members of a program called Alternative Land Use Services. That is, other than food, what do? They protect birds, and in the Netherlands, they have the CARE program. So it's quite easy to institutionalize, and many of these farmers then have 40 revenue streams coming into their farm, not just one for food. They're not only producing food, they're also equally producing environmental services. So I think that's the way we should move.
Thank you, Wayne. I think this was a very nice statement for closing this session off. So, thanks so much to all of you as guests internationally and from within Germany. Thanks very much for your very interesting inputs. And thanks also to you, to the audience, for interesting comments, questions. Yeah, I think we already have like a lot of ideas and new aspects in our minds that we can think about now. And yeah, I think most of us are probably going to meet again tomorrow. So just have a nice evening. I don't know if someone...
At first, I would like to thank the experts. I guess we have many new perspectives from different countries and from different views about this, I guess, the most important topic. That it's a thing we all gotta do, eating. So, secondly, I want to thank all the partners that made this fantastic evening possible, and drittens. Ich möchte Sie alle bewundern dafür, dass Sie so ein unglaubliches Durchhaltevermögen haben. Ich glaube, das zeigt auch, dass Sie vielleicht so Inseln der Lösungen, wir haben das heute gerade mal gehört, möglich machen können. Eben so ein Durchhaltevermögen und dann auch positive Geschichten auf diesen Inseln erzählen können. Ich glaube, es stimmt auch, dass wir da sind, wo wir mit der Energiewende in den 80er Jahren waren. Vielleicht halten uns noch so manche für ein bisschen verrückt, was wir so machen. Wir graben irgendwie mitten in der Stadt irgendwelche Erden um und pflanzen da Radieschen an. Aber ich glaube, in 20 Jahren, in 25 Jahren wird man da ganz anders drauf blicken. In diesem Sinne schaffen wir Veränderungen und noch einen schönen Abend. Dankeschön.
One last point. Eins habe ich noch vergessen. I still forgot one point. Thanks so much for the interpretation.